Thank you, everybody, for being here. We scheduled this during spring break, and we thought, well, maybe we wouldn't get a full room, but obviously we did anyway. And I very much look forward to this discussion. We're going to start with a list of witnesses that we've invited to testify, and so we'll get their testimony first, and then there is a sign-up sheet. I'm not sure exactly where it is, but if there's anyone from the public that would like to testify, we'd be glad to have your testimony as well. And I'm not sure how long the hearing's going to take. I want to move through the testimony, but also want to hear everything that we need to hear. So we may go to noon, break for lunch, and come back, but we'll just wait and see how things proceed. So let's go ahead and start with Jane Lubchenco. Why don't you sit down, Jane? My committee staff is whispering whether we want an introduction from Jennifer Allen from Portland State. Would you want to do that?
Fine.
Why don't you come on up and...
Whatever the chairman says. Thank you. Chair Ringo and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jennifer Allen, and I am a research associate professor here at Portland State University. I'm also the associate director of the International Environmental Safety and Sustainability Education Program. On behalf of President Bernstein, it is my pleasure to welcome you to campus for this hearing. This week is our spring break, as you mentioned, and we hope you will be able to come back and visit campus at a time when our students are here. It's appropriate that the committee would choose to hold this hearing on clean air issues in Oregon at Portland State University because sustainability is a key element of our curriculum and of the operations of the university. My testimony today focuses on the interdisciplinary work that is being done by faculty and students in the areas of air quality and its connections to Oregon's economy, the health of its residents, and livability. Development of effective clean air policies requires research that interweaves science, engineering, public health, and urban planning. At PSU, this work involves approximately 20 faculty members who are in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, the Massey College of Engineering and Computer Science, and the College of Urban and Public Affairs. In the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, scientists are engaged in measuring gaseous and particulate matter constituents of the atmosphere and developing models to understand how atmospheric composition and climate changes over time from the local neighborhood scale to the global scale. In the Massey College of Engineering, researchers investigate how energy consumption, building construction, and transportation planning interact with air quality and livability. In the College of Urban and Public Affairs, researchers investigate transportation models, land use planning, and the public health aspects of air quality. PSU researchers collaborate with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, Oregon Department of Transportation, Metro, Portland's Environmental Services and Sustainable Development Agencies, as well as many community-level organizations. PSU is also home of the Feedbacks Between Urban Systems and the Environment Project, or FUSE Project. FUSE is funded by a $1.7 million grant from the National Science Foundation's Biocomplexity in the Environment Initiative. The goal of this NSF-funded project is to develop an integrated analysis framework that can be used to evaluate human response to and impact on heat waves and episodes of poor air quality, linking models of meteorology, air quality, energy consumption, and human response, and incorporating feedback mechanisms among these individual components. PSU researchers are working to measure the impact of human response to these policies, taking field measurements to accurately measure air pollution and meteorological conditions, and gathering energy and transportation data to quantify human-generated waste heat from activities such as driving and running air conditioning units. Collaborators in this project include Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Transportation, Metro, TriMet, the Portland Office of Sustainable Development, and Portland Area High Schools. Portland is the field site for the first phase of this project. Portland State's faculty take the university's motto, "Let knowledge serve the city," seriously, and incorporate community connections throughout our work. Therefore, on behalf of the faculty who do work in this area, many of whom are in the field during spring break doing their research, I want to express our commitment to provide the results of our research to the legislature if it would be helpful to you. I want to thank you for coming to PSU, and I would be pleased to answer any questions you might have about PSU's programs and faculty research. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dr. Allen. Thank you for welcoming us to PSU. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Lubchenco?
Thank you, Chairman Ringo,
Senator Shields, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jane Lubchenco, and I want to take this opportunity to thank you for an invitation to appear before you today and offer comments that are relevant to Senate Bill 344. I have the pleasure of teaching at Oregon State University, but I'm here in my capacity as an individual citizen of Oregon and as co-chair of the Governor's Advisory Group on Global Warming. My scientific expertise is environmental science and marine biology. My master's degree is from the University of Washington, and my PhD is from Harvard. I'm honored to be a member of the National Academy of Sciences. I've lived in Oregon, taught at OSU, and done research in Oregon's oceans and elsewhere around the world for some 28 years now. Climate change is one of my areas of expertise, in particular, the ways in which climate change is affecting life in oceans and the role that ocean ecosystems play in the climate system. I served on the very first study of global warming that was conducted by the National Academy of Sciences for the first Bush administration. 5 years later, along with six other scientists, I had the privilege of briefing President Clinton and Vice President Gore on climate change at the White House at a special climate roundtable. I've worked closely with multiple administrations, both Republican and Democratic, numerous members of Congress and federal agencies on climate and other environmental issues. As a member of the National Science Board, the former president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and now president of the International Council for Science, I work often at national and international levels. When Governor Kulongoski invited me to co-chair a group to advise him on what Oregon might do to address global warming, I was pleased to be able to accept. In my first foray into state-level political discussions, I've encountered many exceptionally talented, knowledgeable, dedicated, and open-minded Oregonians who care very deeply about our collective future. The Governor's Advisory Committee on Global Warming was an unusual cross-section of Oregonians. 28 of us, citizens and public officials, representing diverse backgrounds and interests from around the state. The group included representatives of the business community that deliver and use energy, farmers, environmentalists, scientists, and many others. My co-chair, Mark Dodson, CEO of Northwest Natural, is a wise and gifted leader, and it was a great pleasure to work closely with him. At its first meeting in February of 2004, the governor charged his advisory group to, quote, develop a climate change strategy for Oregon that would provide long-term sustainability for the environment, protect public health, consider social equity, create economic opportunity, and expand public awareness, unquote. The advisory group embarked upon a year-long journey of discovery, discussion, consultation, and hard work. Together, we learned about climate change, how it is already affecting Oregon, and what might be in our future. We became aware of the actions that other states are taking. We listened to the concerns, ideas, and perspectives of citizens around the state. Recognizing the considerable diversity of perspectives within the group and within the state, we adopted a set of principles to guide the recommendations we hoped to formulate. Those principles emphasized a firm grounding in science, meaningful reductions in Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions, cost-effective actions, investment and entrepreneurial opportunities, and avoiding actions that might impair power system reliability. With these in mind, and with the able assistance of our technical committees, the advisory group explored a broad array of possible elements of a strategy. We whittled these down to those that were feasible and most effective, and crafted a draft report that was widely circulated around the state, including public hearings at three different venues. After incorporating the very useful feedback that we got from citizens, and after almost a full year of hard work, the advisory committee unanimously approved its final report in December. This report is a strong, but feasible package of recommendations that would set Oregon on a path to reverse the upward trend of our greenhouse gas emissions. The fact that the recommendations were all unanimously approved is a powerful message and a reflection of the opportunity that the members had to learn and to work together. Yesterday, the very first copy of the final printed report was delivered to the governor. Today, you are the recipients of the very next set of copies. I respectfully request that this report be entered into the record of today's hearing. Additional copies are available on the state's Department of Energy website. Senate Bill 344 deals with one of the core recommendations in this report, specifically the need to have strong motor vehicle emission standards. I've been asked, in the context of these hearings, to provide scientific context for your deliberations of this topic, specifically to articulate a brief synopsis of what's known about climate change around the world and in the Pacific Northwest in particular. Almost all scientists with relevant expertise now believe that the Earth is warming, that humans are affecting climate, and that continued unchecked climate change will seriously affect the quality of life of people everywhere. Most of those who have examined the evidence find it to be compelling and growing stronger every year. The international group of thousands of scientists with expertise in climate matters, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, issues a periodic report that summarizes what is known about climate change. It is important for you to realize that this is a pretty conservative group of folks. They tend to not say something is happening unless the evidence is pretty overwhelming, and most of their reports are replete with qualifiers because the nuances therein are important. They are the best climate scientists in the world. In 1995, the second assessment report of the IPCC included, quote, "The balance of evidence suggests there is a discernible human influence on climate," unquote. That report drew a considerable amount of attention and elicited a noisy backlash from a small but very vocal and well-funded minority of scientists who disagreed. However, the following years saw record high temperatures, with 1998 being the warmest year on record, and severe storm damage as more and more scientific evidence piled up. In 2001, the IPCC released the third assessment report, providing even stronger evidence of warming. That report concluded, quote, "There is new and stronger evidence that most of the warming observed over the last 50 years is attributable to human activities," unquote. The upward trajectory of average global temperatures continued, with 1998, 2002, and 2003 now the three hottest years on record. The findings of the IPCC have been endorsed by every credible independent assessment conducted by reputable scientists, including a number from the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. As the evidence for climate change increases, there are fewer and fewer contrarians that dismiss the evidence. There has been considerable discussion in the popular press about certainty and uncertainty. Let's examine what is certain and what is uncertain about climate change from a scientific perspective. What is certain? Number one, the greenhouse gas phenomenon is well understood and is in fact very basic science. Greenhouse gases, such as carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and others, in the atmosphere, trap heat and keep the planet's temperature within a certain range. What is certain? Number two, human activities have caused an increase in greenhouse or heat-trapping gases. For example, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has increased by more than 30% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. We know where that carbon dioxide comes from because we can do the equivalent of fingerprinting it. We know that it comes primarily from the burning of fossil fuels, but also due to changes in land use, such as deforestation. This increase in greenhouse gases affects the amount of solar energy coming into and going out of the Earth system, the Earth atmosphere system. An increase in these gases results in more solar energy being trapped and the planet warming. The third thing about which we are certain is that the Earth is warming. Earth's surface air temperature has warmed significantly by about 1 degree Fahrenheit since 1860. And finally, we are certain that sea level is rising. Specifically, we know that sea level rose between 4 and 8 inches over the 20th century. All of these 4 points are well established. What then is uncertain? Actually, quite a bit. It is uncertain how much more the climate will warm or how fast. It's uncertain whether the changes will be gradual or whether they will be characterized by so-called tipping points in which very abrupt change might happen over a very short period of time. It's uncertain how climate changes will be spatially distributed around the Earth. The Earth does not act in unison. Everything doesn't warm just the average amount. There are some places that are much warmer and other places that, in fact, may be cooler. And how this heat is spatially distributed is in large part a function of the complex dynamics between the atmosphere and the oceans and the land. It's also uncertain how human societies will respond to the changes already underway. And it's uncertain how the various components of the climate system interact with one another, and in particular, the influence of feedbacks in the system. Scientists have attempted to model the climate system both to understand its key features, but also to make predictions about future conditions. There are a number of different models, each one dealing with some of the climate system elements in a slightly different fashion, and thus resulting in slightly different predictions. So the IPCC presents a range of possible future scenarios, and these ranges reflect the fact that there are uncertainties in the underlying physical, chemical, biological, and social responses. Over time, the models have become better and better. The third assessment report of the IPCC draws on these models and makes the following predictions. Under a business-as-usual scenario, i.e. continuing on the current trajectory, the planet will likely warm between about 2.5 and 10.5 degrees Fahrenheit by 2100. The IPCC also predicts that sea level will rise between 4 and 35 inches by 2100. This is, in fact, a pretty scary world that these two predictions would entail. A warmer world has higher highs some places than others. A warmer world also has a stronger water cycle. The jargon is the hydrological cycle is intensified. And so as the planet warms, the water is moving through the atmosphere, oceans, and land faster and faster. And so we get more rainfalls and also more droughts. Just like if you're watering your lawn on a very, very warm, sunny day, there's a lot of evaporation that's going into the air. That's what happens with a warmer planet, and that water is recycled. And so you see more and more rainfall events, but also more drought events, depending on the spatial distribution. The predictions about average temperature warming and about sea level rise are the easier ones to make, despite the fact that there are broad ranges that the models give. More difficult, but nonetheless important, are other factors, such as the frequency of extreme precipitation events and intense storms, droughts, outbreaks of pests and pathogens, disease, acidification of oceans, and more. The climate system is simply too complex to make very precise predictions about any of these. However, our lack of ability to predict change does not mean that this change is unlikely. The bottom line is that there are very real changes, quite likely, and these are expected to affect our economies, health, recreational opportunities, and livelihoods. Many of the signs of global warming are already obvious. In my research trips around the world, I've seen far too many of these examples. Immense icebergs floating near the Antarctic continent, calved off from glaciers that are moving very rapidly toward the ocean. Caribbean and Indo-Pacific coral reefs bleached and dying from warmer ocean waters. Disappearing glaciers in New Zealand, in South America, in North America, and in Europe. Insect outbreaks devastating birch forests in Europe, in the Arctic. And beachfront properties disappearing beneath waves around the world, and more. However, one need not travel to see evidence of climate change. There are signs in our own backyards. Last summer, a group of scientists from the Pacific Northwest convened at OSU to review evidence for climate changes in our region and to evaluate the likely impacts of further changes. One of the significant and important improvements in climate models is their ability to treat climate changes at the regional scale. The scientists at this meeting included experts in oceanography, hydrology, forest ecology, climate, marine ecology, fisheries, agriculture, and economics. They reviewed not only the models, but the actual evidence for changes in the Pacific Northwest. They shared their findings through a scientific consensus statement on the likely impacts of climate change in the Pacific Northwest. That document, signed by 50 PhD scientists with relevant expertise, was available to the governor's advisory group, and I also present it to you today. I would appreciate it if this document, too, could be entered into today's record.
It will.
The signatories of this document agree, quote, that climate change is underway and that it is having global effects as well as impacts on the Pacific Northwest region. The document summarizes climate change impacts that have been documented over the last few decades. Number one, the Pacific Northwest is warming. Number two, average annual precipitation in the Pacific Northwest has increased. Number three, land on the central and northern Oregon coast is being submerged by rising sea level. Number four, snowpack has declined. Those are the things that we have good evidence and that the scientists feel confident are significant changes that are demonstrable. The report also makes a number of predictions about likely changes over the next 10 to 50 years. I'll enumerate 10 of them for you. The Pacific Northwest will continue to warm, perhaps by as much as 3 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit over the next 40 years. There will be more summer drought. Forests will be more vulnerable to insects, disease, and fire. Snowpack will continue to diminish. Water resource conflicts will likely increase. Precipitation changes, however, are too uncertain to call. Sea level will continue to rise. Stream flows will occur earlier in the season. Ocean circulation will continue to change with increased upwelling as a likely result. It's uncertain whether these oceanic changes will have adverse impacts such as the hypoxic or so-called dead zones we saw in 2002 and 2004 off the Central Oregon coast that were studied by my PSCO research team. And finally, we expect more frequent and harmful floods and more coastal erosion. So that's a brief summary of the changes we've already seen underway and a look to the future about what is likely given our current understanding of how the climate system impacts the Pacific Northwest. Based on this and other information, the Governor's Advisory Group on Global Warming decided that it was time for Oregon to join the 28 other states that have or are preparing action plans to reduce greenhouse gases. Moreover, the group's report emphasizes, this is the Governor's Advisory Group now, emphasizes the positive economic returns that would accrue from stimulating new businesses and providing Oregonians with reliable, low-cost energy. The actions recommended in our report include making homes, offices, and factories more energy efficient, developing new renewable energy resources from wind, the sun, and crops harvested as biofuels, sequestering carbon, reducing waste, and increasing recycling, and, particularly relevant to your deliberations, reducing greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles. Other members of the Governor's Advisory Group on Global Warming are here today and are prepared to provide additional information about our recommendations, especially those that are relevant to Senate Bill 344. So let me close by thanking you for your attention and congratulate you on your willingness to discuss these critically important topics, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lubchenco. Very impressive presentation, and I thank you for not only coming here today, but for the work you've done on this subject over the years. I was looking at the executive summary that you handed out that's signed by 50 professors.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that, I mean, they're from many, many scientific disciplines.
Correct.
How do you respond to people who just don't think that the scientific weight supports the conclusion that humans are a factor in global warming? What's the best response to that?
I think in the early days of when scientists first saw evidence and started talking about what they saw as changing, many citizens didn't see evidence in their own experiences and were compelled by the way the topic was treated in the press, which was in an attempt to give equal coverage. You know, 1,000 scientists saying one thing was given equal weight to one scientist saying something on the opposite side, which is the tradition within journalism. And in fact, I think there was a lot of confusion about what was really going on. As over the last couple of decades, and as the planet has continued to warm, I think the evidence is becoming stronger and stronger. And in many individual citizens' own experiences, there are just too many weird things happening. And all of those, I think it's important to note that any particular event, one cannot ascribe any particular event, a huge flood, a drought, any one thing, to climate change with 100% certainty. That said, our understanding of climate change is such that most of these weird things that we have been observing to happen are completely consistent with our understanding of the climate system and with the predictions that were made. So I think there will always be individuals who don't believe something. That's the way human nature is. But I think that the evidence is becoming so compelling and so overwhelming on the scientific side, but also in many citizens' own personal experiences, that it's pretty difficult to just blow it off.
Okay. Thank you very much. Question from the committee.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. This is a very impressive presentation. I wanted to ask you, just from a scientific standpoint, you talked about the increase in the, I can't remember the word you used, but the activity of the hydrology.
Mm-hmm. Everything moves, the water cycle.
The water cycle. Everything mm-hmm. moves faster, and then you document some of the effects that it would have. But what's next? What comes next? I mean, how does it end up correcting itself?
So there's a constant amount of water that's in the Earth system, and it moves from the atmosphere to the land, to the oceans, to the atmosphere. And that amount of water doesn't change. What changes as the world is warming is the rate at which that water is being moved through those systems. And so you have more evaporation, hence more droughts, and you have some more intense precipitation events. Water cycle is amplified. It's water is being cycled faster and faster. In concert with that, you also have different weather patterns, so that you might get more rain some places and less rain other places. In the Pacific Northwest in particular, an additional factor is that as our area is warming, what would normally be accumulated as snowpack, because it's warmer, the snowpack melts earlier, and so we don't have the snowpack retained throughout longer into the spring. That can supply us water for the summertime, but in fact, that same precipitation is flowing down streams and rivers earlier in the season. And so we have a change in the seasonality of the peak stream flows. We're getting peak stream flows earlier and earlier, and less water as for our summer, and so hence the suggestions that there will be increased drought in the Pacific Northwest. And in fact, the year is not over yet, but we are significantly behind on our snowpack, and the very warm and very dry winters that we've had are completely consistent with what we would expect.
Well, to follow up, one way of ending the global warming cycle is to reduce the population of people who are causing global warming, and I say this partially tongue-in-cheek, I guess, but one of the questions I had is, what is the impact of these trends on the kind of microbes and viruses and bacteria that could actually have a health effect on especially overpopulated countries?
So I think it's important to recognize that those of us in the developed world are actually contributing. We represent about a quarter of the world's population, and we contribute about three-quarters of the world's greenhouse gas emissions today. That's changing very rapidly as populations in India and China in particular are growing very, very rapidly, and as their use of energy, fossil fuel energy, is increasing. But your question is directly with respect to possible health implications. And indeed, many of the diseases that are more prevalent in warmer parts of the world, in the tropics, would be expected to expand into areas where they don't now occur as those areas become warmer. Depending on whether you're talking about malaria or dengue fever or yellow fever, there are a number of different mosquito-borne and other diseases that are fully expected to increase in severity and in spatial extent with very serious consequences globally. Countries that have less of a public health infrastructure will be more susceptible. Ones that have more public health infrastructure, such as ours, are better able to cope, and yet they, too, will be very, very stretched to deal with the additional health challenges.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Shields.
I just want to push that a little bit. Mm-hmm. We didn't respond too well by having enough influenza vaccine on hand when it was needed. Can you develop a scenario or two where something like what Senator Burdick was referring to might, you know, kind of pop up and our reaction time could be ridiculously slow? And
yeah, I think this is one of the biggest concerns about climate change or some of the surprises that might be on the horizon. It's unlikely that we're going to be able to predict all of the kinds of changes that might happen. One of the climate-related diseases that we have seen is hantavirus, and this is not a mosquito-borne disease. And it is fully expected to increase in frequency and in spatial extent. And we that's one example of one that we may not be fully prepared to deal with. There will undoubtedly be surprises, and I think the smart tack is twofold. One, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, first and foremost, so that we can reduce the problem down the road, but in parallel to that, be better prepared for the changes that will inevitably occur because of the greenhouse gases that have already been put into the atmosphere and that are going to continue to affect climate and bring surprises in the next in the decades ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lubchenco. I really appreciate your testimony here today. Jason Mark, would you like to testify?
Well, thank you very much, Senator Ringo, and members of the committee. I'm honored to be invited to join you today, and I know there's some concern in California, and there's a concern of people in my state coming to inundate your state, and I promise you that my flight is, in fact, leaving this afternoon, so I do intend to go home. But again, thank you so much. My name is Jason Mark. I'm the director of the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. As a 35-year-old organization, we're focused on research and policy where science and technology play a role. And I'm going to spend the majority of my time talking about vehicle technologies and the opportunity before you. But also want to start out talking a bit about climate change as well. This is a significant issue and an area of both research and policy work at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We have the opportunity to work with world-class scientists such as Dr. Lubchenco on a routine basis, and I'm going to attempt here very briefly to punctuate with pictures some of the points that Dr. Lubchenco mentions and then quickly move into cars. So let's see if our slides work here. You in fact have the slides in front of you as well. My apologies, you won't get the full color version unless you're able to look at the scrawny screen on the ahead of you. But this is the famous, often called hockey stick slide. With all due respect to the dear departed National Hockey League this season. That demonstrates that the last century's temperature increases are significant departure from the millennial trend in terms of temperature rises. And this sort of trend is precisely what is leading the world-class scientists involved in the International Panel on Climate Change to suggest that natural variation alone cannot explain this, that humans are, in fact, are driving up temperature through fossil fuel combustion and other key sources. But the results, of course, can be observed already in places like the Pacific Northwest. So this is a map of Idaho, Washington, and Oregon, and demonstrates measured, observed temperature increases that I think also Dr. Lubchenco referenced. And these temperature increase observations are consistent with the pattern of climate change that we've seen from a more global perspective. But those temperature increases drive, of course, a range of potential impacts. Perhaps none more important than in the entire Western Coast region than water. And this is a slide, again, just punctuating a point that Dr. Lubchenco made. emphasizing that April 1st snowpack, so the spring snowpack, is declining precipitously. This is over the last 50 years in the Pacific Northwest, particularly here in Oregon at the lower elevations in the Cascades. And this, of course, has potential for dramatic implications for electric power production, for agriculture, for fish, for urban use. But be that as it may, these observed trends become, in fact, an important bellwether to thinking about future changes. And I want to describe to you now some more recent analyses that we were involved in at UCS with a team of 19 scientists published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences last summer that looks at projected temperature increases using the latest state-of-the-art models and the latest emission scenarios generated by the third assessment report that Dr. Lubchenco references. And here I think we see that the potential temperature increases over the United States, and particularly the western United States and, in fact, the Pacific Northwest, are more dramatic than previous predictions. And that's an unfortunate conclusion of having better models that are doing a better job predicting the historic record, as well as hopefully projecting future temperature increases, as well as these new emission scenarios. But it's troubling. And so if you look, for example, in the wintertime potential increases on the order of 5 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit throughout the West Coast region, and then it's difficult to see the contrast here, but as much as 18 degrees Fahrenheit increase in summertime average temperature in parts of the Pacific Northwest and in California. That's a dramatic increase, much more significant than previous estimates. And it is, of course, has the potential for consequences throughout the hydrological cycle, public health, range of other arenas, ecology, certainly. But this is a scenario that is associated with sort of the business-as-usual type of future, that the sort of the path that we're on. We've called it here the higher emissions path, hoping that we might not see a higher path. And this is the world in fact, perhaps our children and our grandchildren will be challenged with, again, significant temperature increases. The good news is, from our perspective, is that there is a lower emissions path, and this is using as an input the lower emissions scenario from a global perspective developed by the IPCC to estimate markedly lower, at least half or less, temperature increases associated with a world where globally we control emissions. And I think this is offers us there's very little hope in a lot of this global climate change science research, but this, I think, in fact, does emphasize that there are opportunities to avert the worst impact. So how do we do that? Oh, yes.
Yes, Senator Shields.
What's the time frame here that you're talking about? I'm just trying to...
Sure, thank you. This is end of the century. What we've done here is taken an average projected temperature increases for the period 2070 through 2099, so the last three decades of this century, and compared them to the average temperature over three decades of the last century. So climate action, we can't move forward on climate policy without the United States taking action. The U.S., as you see here, accounts for a quarter of the world's energy-related carbon dioxide emissions. And yet, unfortunately, we have a tremendous policy vacuum at the federal level. Even as many who argue we shouldn't act, even as China and India develop, official predictions suggest the U.S. will still be the world's top CO2 emitter 20 years hence. And so we have really no excuse not to act. But in the midst of this policy vacuum, states and regions, such as Oregon, are stepping into the void, and that can have a significant and dramatic impact both on the policy world but also in terms of actual emissions reductions. And here I've just put in place the aggregate emissions for either the northeastern states, where a fair amount of climate policy action is underway, or the West Coast states, where, again, we're seeing from Washington down through Oregon and California important movement, that those efforts are, in fact, on a global scale, extremely valuable and extremely important in terms of reducing emissions. In effect, if what this suggests is if the West Coast states were to secede, they'd still be in the top 10 of emitters, and we'll keep the discussion of secession to a separate hearing, I imagine. Future day. But this is just a quick effort. It's incomplete and a bit bumpy effort to try to demonstrate that on both coasts there are substantial efforts going forward in terms of setting targets, developing registries, developing blueprints and roadmaps. establishing vehicle standards, caps on the electric power sector. I haven't included here renewable energy efforts, which are also a vital component to climate action. But we're seeing important effort from the coast, and Oregon's efforts are essential to keeping this momentum moving forward. And I can tell you, as a member of the of California, State of California's Advisory Committee on Climate Action, I have to commend the efforts of your Oregon group for developing what I think is a model report, and one that I think, as we deliberate over the next 12 months or so in California, we can only hope to match in terms of quality of technical analysis as well as a comprehensive perspective. So I really commend that analysis to you. But a key feature of the report is outlined, of course, by the governor's effort, and a key component of California's and the Northeastern efforts moving forward are vehicle standards. And so let me talk a little bit about the value from a global perspective and then from a very local and consumer perspective of adopting vehicle policies to address greenhouse gases and air pollution. First of all, it's quite clear that we can't solve the challenge of global warming without addressing cars in the United States. If U.S. passenger vehicles were their own country, they'd be ranked fifth in the world as a global emitter of carbon dioxide emissions. So they emit more than the entire country of India from all of its sources, a tremendous and significant source. But even more important moving forward, I would argue that the United States, its inaction has become a roadblock to globalizing clean car technology that is critical not just for reducing emissions in developed countries, but perhaps more importantly in offering up clean and affordable technology to developing countries as they continue to, as their markets continue to expand as vehicle technology introduced, for example, in China, India.
Mr. Mark, what percent of CO2 emissions are caused by vehicles?
In the United States, it's 20%. And that's when I say vehicles, in that definition, it's just our cars and our light trucks, so through SUVs. If you add in all transportation in the United States, it's roughly a third of our greenhouse gas emissions.
And what are the other sources?
Electricity is a even more significant source, roughly 40% in the United States, and then you move sort of down to
coal-burning power plants? Is that
largely dominated by coal-burning power plants, but even natural gas, of course, is a significant source of greenhouse gases.
Thank you.
At the national scale. So California has been given special authority to set its own vehicle tailpipe standards. Unlike any other state in the union under the Clean Air Act, this dates back to the 1970s, and it's been using that authority to establish national precedents for vehicle technology and vehicle pollution controls for 40 years. It's been quite successful. Today, other states can adopt, as you well know, California's rules or stick with the less aggressive federal program. And to date, seven northeastern states have adopted California's rules. That means one out of every four cars sold in America is built to meet these tighter standards. And that has a dramatic consequences for the pace of technology development. It enhances and accelerates the progress of technology. It gives consumers better choices, as I'll suggest. And Oregon's inclusion in this package is a tremendous opportunity to build momentum, to join your neighbors to the south and hopefully soon your neighbors to the north in adopting a clean car technology. And there are tremendous health and consumer benefits. So let me just spend my last few minutes talking through some of the features of the program and the environmental and consumer benefits of the vehicle standards that are involved in the California package. First of all, superior air quality protection. These are results from the Northeast, where on average we are the estimates suggest a 15% additional reduction in smog-forming hydrocarbon emissions and somewhere between a fifth and a quarter additional reductions in toxic emissions associated with hydrocarbons, in the Northeast. And the results will vary for Oregon based on your vehicle mix, but it's an important and an additional health protection associated with the California program. Also, drive to new technology. This is a key feature as we all think about this burgeoning market of extremely popular hybrid electric vehicles that the automakers have been very quick to tout as a long-term solution to air pollution and climate change. We certainly agree one of the best ways to get hybrid vehicles into your state is to require them. And the California program, in fact, essentially guides hybrid vehicles. There's a limited supply, and there will be a limited supply over the next few years. It's going to guide those vehicles to the states to adopt the California regulations that require them. So, in other words, in a limited pool of hybrid vehicles, all consumers are competing in some respects. The states that have this zero-emission vehicle program will get the benefit of having their customers having access to hybrid electric vehicles.
Just to ask you to follow up on that. So because of California standards, the manufacturers will push more of the hybrid or electric vehicles to California to help them meet the fleet averages.
Right. This slide, in fact, suggests that in 10 years from now, roughly 13% of all new vehicles sold in California have to be either a hybrid vehicle or an equivalent vehicle such as a natural gas-based car. And that is going to be the same in Massachusetts, the same in New York, and, of course, the same in Oregon if Oregon adopts the California program.
And how does that work in the marketplace? I mean, how do they ensure that people buy those cars?
Well, the auto industry has dealt with, of course, these types of requirements for 40 years since we've had air pollution standards. And so they have to meet specifically, in this case, a certain percentage of vehicles that they produce for the market. Of course, our sense is with an industry that spends on the order of $18 billion a year in advertising for new cars, they'll probably do a pretty good job of being able to offer up to consumers and get into consumers' hands these types of products. In the case of hybrid vehicles, I think the case is very easy. There's just a tremendous demand. You've got long, long waiting lists for the vehicle technology, more product offerings. And so the automaker essentially needs to ensure that they're guiding supply to what I would argue is a tremendous demand.
Is there a backlog of consumers who are just waiting to buy the hybrid vehicles in California?
There are, and in fact there's a backlog in many other states, but the backlogs are of course going to be shorter in states where they're required, where the automakers are required to produce them.
Okay, thank you.
Which is sort of my core concept here. And then of course the new feature that is really the captured international attention is the additional climate protection that's now built into the California program. Here, California will be requiring a new vehicle in 2012 to reduce its emissions by roughly 22% compared to today's average or 2002 average, and a 30% reduction in 2016. Those are important but extremely feasible and extremely cost-effective reductions, as I'll just point out. In fact, here's a list of the types of technologies that automakers might use to meet the new standards, and I just want to emphasize that, in fact, many of these technologies are already in the market. Many of the technologies they'll need to meet the 2012 standards, just a matter of engineering design and moving them into the marketplace. For example, air conditioning technologies that essentially tighten up leaks in our automotive mobile air conditioners already are being required and moving into place in Europe. Engine technologies, variable valve lift and timing, which does a better job of getting fuel and air into the engine, are in every single one of Toyota's new passenger cars, not all of their trucks yet, every single one of Honda's cars that they sell in the U.S., not in every single one of every other automaker's cars. So that's a technology, tremendous opportunity. Cylinder deactivation turns off some of your cylinders when you don't need the full power. That's technology that's in General Motors and Daimler Chrysler vehicles today and soon Honda's. If you've got Hemi in a V8, as the commercial says, you've got cylinder deactivation. Advanced transmissions, Lincoln Navigator, Volkswagen, I won't bore you with more examples, but if you go to an auto show and walk around the floor, you can't but bump into some of these technologies, and in fact, many of these technologies that are going to reduce emissions. Perhaps most importantly, and this is my final slide and final point, is that the technologies to reduce emissions from motor vehicles also save consumers money. And in fact, this component of the California standards may be the most cost-effective, from a consumer's perspective, the most cost-effective air pollution regulation ever for motor vehicles. And that is because the costs up front deliver operational savings over the life of the vehicle. So just focusing in on what we call the Phase 1 or 2012 vehicle, the average new vehicle, according to the state of California, will cost roughly $326 more at the dealership. But over the life of that vehicle, the driver is going to save over $2,000. And just putting that in very simple payback terms, that additional $326 you're going to get back in savings in about 1.4 years. Another way to think about it, since most people, in fact...
And that's based on $2 a gallon.
And that's based on $2 a gallon, a number we'd love to see in California over the coming months.
What is it right there?
I just spent $2.30 this past weekend.
Okay.
Of course, the... a bumpy oil market moving into the summer is going to push those numbers closer to $3 a gallon, I think, as many oil analysts suggest. But many people, in fact, finance their cars. In fact, I would suggest the majority of folks finance their cars, let's say, over 5 years. And so, in fact, for those people, you finance the addition, you spread those additional costs over 5 years. And what that means is that the additional costs to your loan payments are going to get offset immediately in the additional savings. So, in fact, your first month after the lot, you save, we estimate here, $11 with the lower metering vehicle. And so let me just summarize by saying that I think the consensus is emerging. Climate change is a significant threat to the health of our economy and to our people. That action is absolutely critical. State and regional efforts are a key part of the global process to addressing this challenge. And quite honestly, particularly when it comes to vehicle standards, but many other efforts to address climate action, even if you weren't interested in climate change whatsoever, this would be smart fiscal policy. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I guess I could ask my committee if there are any questions.
And perhaps they voted with their feet.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mark. I'd like to hear from the auto manufacturers, Paul Cosgrove and Steve Douglas, please. Going to read that whole notebook, are you?
I'll start midway.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Paul Cosgrove, for the record, representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, and with me is Steve Douglas from the Alliance's office in Sacramento. Steve's been intimately familiar with the development of California emission standards over the years, including the most recent development of carbon dioxide standards. One of the things that you're being handed is a piece of a summary of our concerns about Senate Bill 344, and I'd like to point out that we're not going to talk about global warming and general issues. We're going to talk specifically about Senate Bill 344. And just to bring you back to what that subject is, Senate Bill 344 would require that the Environmental Quality Commission adopt by 2009, or effective for the 2009 model year of motor vehicles, and all subsequent model years, the standards that developed in California. And the bill says that those standards must be identical to California standards, and there's a reason for that. Under federal law, although California has some latitude if it applies for and receives waivers from EPA to have different standards than the rest of the country. And in some circumstances, other states can choose to adopt those California standards. It's California or federal. Those are the only two choices. The law is clear that we don't have the ability to take a third route. The second issue I'd like to point out is, and I think Mr. Marcus has touched on it, is that we're really talking about two different kinds of standards here. California has what is commonly known as the LEV standards, which stands for low emission vehicle standards. And those are the kinds of standards that California has set over the years. It actually started to set vehicle emission standards before the federal government did. It did so back in the 60s, and the federal government did so starting in the early 70s. Those standards address a certain kind of pollutants, which we call under the Clean Air Act criteria pollutants. Those are the poisonous and smog-creating kinds of things like carbon monoxide, hydrocarbons, volatile organic compounds, those kinds of things. California does have an exemption to be able to develop those standards under EPA waivers. Other states do, in certain circumstances, it's not clear that Oregon fits those circumstances, have the ability to adopt those standards. But that doesn't essentially address the topic that we've heard most about today, which is global warming. Those are criteric pollutants. What California then did a number of years ago, and its air agency called the California Air Resources Board just has adopted rules last fall, is set a new kind of standard on carbon dioxide, the global warming gas that you heard from Dr. Lubchenco so much about and so accurately about. That is a very different issue under federal law. So one of the things I'm going to try to provide for you is this bill raises a host of questions, some of them environmental, some of them economic, but many of them also legal. Mr. Mark knows very well that there is ongoing litigation both in California and in the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia dealing with the ability either for EPA, that's the D.C. suit, or California, that's the California lawsuit, to adopt standards regulating emissions of carbon dioxide from vehicles. And you might say, why? Why is that different than all those other pollutants? And the answer is, the Clean Air Act covers criteria pollutants. EPA does not believe it covers carbon dioxide global warming issues, and has so ruled in response to and is taking that position in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. But in addition, it's very clear that while California has an exemption to provide different standards under certain circumstances for criteria pollutants, no state has the authority to set standards related to fuel economy. Why is that relevant to carbon dioxide? Let me just give you the simplest non-technical answer I can, because I'm not a technical person. We measure fuel economy in the United States, that's how EPA does it, by measuring carbon dioxide. Reduction in carbon dioxide is increase in fuel economy, essentially on an even graph. So the lawsuit in California challenges that second part of the California emissions, the ones dealing with carbon dioxide, the ones dealing with global warming. Back to the bill and back to the governor's advisory group. The advisory group, I think, I can state pretty clearly, did not have a great deal of discussion about the intricacies of this issue, including the legal intricacies, because I attended every single one of the Transportation Technical Committee meetings and every single one of the Advisory Committee meetings, and I participated in that. And that's why I think the advisory group wisely proposed that the governor establish a task force, which over the next year or two, whatever is necessary, will look at these issues in greater detail. Not only the environmental issues, but the technical, economic, and legal issues. But that's not what Senate Bill 344 does. I'd like to comment on one thing about hybrids, because it's a stunning fact. California's regulations have not driven the majority of hybrids to California. The state with the highest per capita sales of hybrids in the United States is Oregon. Without California standards. We're only second to the District of Columbia, which most of us still don't call an independent state, but District of Columbia has the highest percentage and Oregon has the second. It will not increase the availability of hybrids in Oregon to adopt California standards. That's not been the history of how the market has worked, and frankly, there are many, many legal restrictions on us diverting cars, different kinds of cars to different kinds of states, including the franchise laws in this state and every state of the union. Second, by adopting California's emission standards, skipping the carbon dioxide standards for a moment, we are moving in lockstep with the California Air Resources Board, and I think it'd be helpful to discuss how CARB has dealt with emissions limits over the years. First of all, California's emissions limits for the criteria pollutants, carbon monoxide, hydrocarbons, have changed 49 times. California has just recently submitted the changes that it did in 1999, 2001, and 2003 to the federal government for a waiver. Some of the things you're hearing about in terms of most recent California standards have not even yet been approved by the Environmental Protection Agency. And if we link ourselves to California, we will be linking ourselves to decisions made by the California Air Resources Board. Let me give you an example of one of those decisions that I think has a special impact in Oregon. California, you cannot buy a car that is run on diesel, including biodiesel, or a light truck run on diesel. California does not permit them. If you went to the website of any number of manufacturers that worldwide who make diesel cars, and we picked Volkswagen because it's one of our members, and it has a number of diesel cars. It'll talk about the diesel Jetta, It'll talk about the much better mileage the diesel Jetta will get, and it will talk about the states in which the diesel Jetta cannot be sold, and those include California and those seven Northeast states that have adopted California regulations. So if we're concerned about developing our own biodiesel industry here in Oregon, and for the benefits both in terms of global warming and other benefits that that has, we should not adopt California's regulations.
I guess, Paul, you know, it may not be perfect for Oregon to tie our regulations to California's to California's regulations, but I think we're a lot more comfortable doing that than waiting for EPA or the federal government to do the right thing. And until we can get the EPA or the federal government to do the right thing on this issue, then it's a strong improvement to adopt the California regulations.
Mr. Chairman, with respect to the California regulations on criteria pollutants, and I've given you a chart attached to my testimony, I think you'll find that EPA has already adopted what it calls Tier 2 standards that effectively get us to exactly the same place, although they're measured a little bit differently. There was a slide shown to you that says that California standards with respect, again, to criteria pollutants are tighter than the federal standards. That's based on a report done by an organization in the Northeast. I'll be glad to supply the committee with a copy of a letter from EPA that talks about why that report is inaccurate in that regard, mostly because the report didn't look at the heaviest SUVs in its analysis, plus a number of other things.
Well, still, I'm just saying you point out some problems with our tying ourselves to California.
Correct.
And I'm willing to concede that's not perfect, but I think it moves us a long way in the direction that we ought to go.
Well, if you're talking about carbon dioxide, it most certainly would require dramatic reductions in carbon dioxide if, in fact, California has the authority to do that.
Right. So if we can't buy diesel Jettas in Oregon, I think we could probably live with that.
I just know that, Senator Ringo, that there are a number of members of the body who are particularly interested in developing clean fuels.
That's right.
And when you take out the market, the local market, for one aspect of that clean fuel development, it certainly affects our ability to develop those clean
fuels. That's right. I agree with you.
And California is specifically anti-diesel. So I think the committee just needs to know that.
That's fair.
The testimony that we provided also gives you some information on what the industry has already done. And as you know, and I don't think there's any dispute about this, cars, in terms of criteria pollutants, are 99% cleaner than they used to be. Cars are also more efficient in their use of fuel. Now, fuel efficiency is different from fuel economy, and I'd like to explain that difference. We are more efficient with our automobiles like trucks and SUVs in moving pounds down the road, but the American consumer has chosen to use up much of that efficiency by buying heavier cars and bigger cars. Oregon is in the forefront of that trend. We were one of the first groups of states where over half the vehicles sold in this state were light trucks, which are pickups, SUVs, and minivans. Now, most states in the country have unfortunately followed our lead and are over half in that category. American consumers have not chosen, and Oregon consumers in particular, have not chosen to buy as many of the lighter and more fuel-efficient cars that the industry's made. There are currently 30 models of cars available and being sold in Oregon that have more than 30 miles per gallon. We don't sell as many of those as we do as SUVs. And one of the problems with fuel economy standards is the industry is required to look at its total fleet. And on a national level, because that's a national set of standards that states can't vary, we have to ensure that for every SUV with a lower miles per gallon that's sold, we sell enough of the smaller cars with the smaller engines with higher miles per gallon so that we get the appropriate average. That's been difficult, and it's getting increasingly difficult. It's not that our cars are in fact any less efficient using fuel. Americans are spending that fuel efficiency on buying bigger cars.
Could you just wrap it up in a couple of minutes, please, Paul?
Sure. Actually, there's a good deal of other information that what I'd like to do is just file for the record. I have testimony here from the Associated Oregon Industries, the Associated Oregon Loggers, and others that I'll submit for the record who are in opposition to Senate Bill 344. I'll close and then turn it over to Mr. Douglas if he has any additional comments by suggesting that the recommendation of the advisory group to form a task force we think is appropriate. We've been working with the governor's office on that. That's not what would happen if Senate Bill 344 passed, so we oppose that bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Welcome to Oregon, Mr. Douglas. You're from Sacramento.
I'm from Sacramento,
you
California.
You can stay here
as well
if you want.
I'd like to. But no, just in the interest of time and getting back to California, which I'm sure you're anxious for me to do, I'll just stay here and answer any questions I have. I'm the Director of Environmental Affairs. I've spent the last almost a decade now working in California on California's vehicle emission regulations. So if you have any questions about the program as it exists today, as it existed 10 years ago, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Senator Shields.
I guess it was guilt by association. I thought you were. I was out of the room when Paul started. So are you here with?
Yeah, they came up
yes.
together.
Okay, you. What's your title again?
I'm sorry. I'm the Director of Environmental Affairs for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. Okay. I'm based out of Sacramento, California.
From your perspective, what is the scientific basis of the anti-diesel position of California? I'm going to be asking that of any other experts I can find, so I thought I'd start with you.
The scientific basis for, not clear, I understand. Are you asking?
I mean,
how?
Yeah, Paul was making reference to the fact that California is particularly anti-diesel.
Oh, absolutely.
And if California is particularly anti-diesel, what was the scientific basis of that?
I think it was about 4 years ago California declared diesel particulate as a toxic air contaminant, and put in place a number of measures to reduce those. But even before that, the Air Resources Board, and that's who sets the standards, adopted the Low Emission Vehicle 2 program. When they did that, the staff had recommended allowing additional flexibility. The board at that time, in that flexibility, would have allowed diesels to be sold in the state of California. The board specifically made the decision that no, they didn't want to have diesels in the state in the light-duty vehicle fleet.
Well, Mr. Douglas, isn't it generally accepted that diesel emissions are particularly harmful to human health?
Well, it depends on how the technology. I mean, diesels have made tremendous progress in reducing emissions. As far as the air quality goes, what the EPA's flexibility does is you meet an average so that from an air quality standpoint, there's no difference.
Well, that's true when you're talking about an average, but I know there's a lot of effort to reduce diesel emissions in Oregon, whether it's school buses or trucks or just general diesel emissions. I mean, Paul's nodding. I think
yeah.
I might hear that.
I
mean, it's recognized that the particulates associated with diesel emissions are particularly bad for people.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just interject, there's another piece of testimony I passed out from a gentleman who's a scientist with Daimler Chrysler that speaks specifically to the diesel issue.
Right.
There's a difference between diesel, old diesel, and clean diesel, and frankly, biodiesel.
Right.
Biodiesel with new clean diesel technology, which this industry has promoted in Congress and everywhere else for a long time, is now available. And it's a very different situation than that which you're encountering with older school buses, which are old diesel. So diesel is, in fact, how the Europeans are meeting the carbon dioxide reductions that they're trying to get from their auto fleets. That is the world's general chosen method to do that, and with clean diesel it can be done with appropriate levels of emissions.
Thank you. A question, I guess, for either one of you. I have great confidence in technology if you give people the right incentive and enough time. I mean, we're able to do a lot. Don't you think that if we require cleaner vehicles, less CO2 reduction, that's going to give the manufacturers the incentive to come up with better technology to meet the standards?
Let me take a policy response, then Mr. Douglas can maybe take a technical one. There's been discussion about whether California's new CO2 requirements can be done with off-the-shelf technology. And those take in effect first with model year 2009. First of all, backing up, Model year 2009 starts in January 1, 2008. We are right now in model year 2006 and have been for a couple of months. That's not very far down the road. It is a very complicated set of things to do to remanufacture cars. As you've probably read in general, you know, materials in the media, to get a new car from design to market is not a simple matter. California's Air Resources Board has often predicted two things. One, we could do things cheaper than we thought we could do it, and two, we could do things faster. Let me give you two examples of where very recently that's turned out not to be true. This last month, on agricultural pumps, water pumps, it's not a car, but it's another kind of machinery that emits, that California controls the emissions. California had to pass an emergency rule because 2 years ago it said off-the-shelf technology would be available to allow these things to meet its limits. It did not do so. Let me give you a second example. California said that the battery vehicles that they were requiring and then dropped the requirement a number of years ago, back several years ago, would cost consumers $1,350. It was over $23,000. California's Air Resources Board is not necessarily the best predictor of what the industry can, in fact, do technologically or economically.
Well, I'm sure you're going to have glitches like that. It just seems to me an incentive is going to have an impact on the technology and on the research. But go ahead, Mr. Douglas.
I think you're right. I think the incentive, though, is the marketplace itself. I think all the manufacturers, they have programs for, be it hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, hybrid vehicles, and the market is driving that to a large extent. And a number of other technologies, diesel technology, which achieves tremendous fuel economy gains.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Mark, could you just come back up briefly and talk about this diesel issue? What's California doing on that?
Good to see my California colleagues. Of course, yes. Good to see my California colleagues across the border here. I think Mr. Douglas's characterization of sort of the scientific basis is pretty much spot on. Let me just add a couple other items, which is that California has evaluated the risk of cancer from outdoor air and diesel exhaust. In fact, accounts, according to the state's estimates, for roughly 70% of the cancer risk from outdoor air in California.
The diesel?
Diesel exhaust. Now, to be fair, the majority of that is from freight trucks, old school buses, not passenger vehicles. But the Air Resources Board was trying to be, of course, clear and take important precautions to expanding a diesel technology if it were going to be dirty. And let me just be crystal clear here. First of all, the industry has widely characterized their technology as being 99% cleaner. The diesel technology doesn't fit in that category. It is, in fact, substantially dirtier than the gasoline vehicles. Second of all, this is a technology that is emerging, and the auto industry, in fact, I think is innovating to the point where we fully expect diesel technology to meet California standards down the road. This is not about making a choice between global warming protection and air pollution. It's about innovating so that we don't have to make that choice. We can have cleaner cars as well as diesel cars.
Thank you very much. Senator Fields?
Yeah, just to follow up. So it's not an anti-diesel. California is not anti-diesel per se. They are anti a certain
pollution.
Level of pollution. Can, at the present time, or would it be possible soon, that biodiesel could in California meet those standards?
I think, quite honestly, conventional petroleum diesel is going to meet those standards. Toyota and several other automakers have demonstrated to EPA technology that over, I think, time with some improvements in engineering will meet the California standard. Biodiesel helps, certainly, in meeting some of the emissions reductions, although the particulate matter standards in California are perhaps less the challenge than the more stringent nitrogen oxide standards in California. But suffice it to say, again, California did not ban diesel cars. It said, we're going to set an environmental performance standard to protect the public health of our citizens, and you can let any technology you want meet the standard. But if it can't, don't sell it in California.
Thank you, Phil. Another question, Mr. Mark. How do you respond to the point raised that California has raised its changed its rules 45 times? Is this going to cause a problem in Oregon? We're always whipsawed by what you guys in Sacramento are doing.
You know, I think history has shown that the Air Resources Board, when it comes to sort of conventional technologies, has been on extremely firm ground. The Air Board recognized early on that the battery technology effort was a was a stretch, that they're pushing for zero emissions technology. It was a target. They didn't know how they're going to get there. And so, in fact, what they did is set up a series of technical reviews to check on that. And it's that's when those changes happened. But we're really building here, I think, when we talk about the more conventional technologies needed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, building on 4 decades of experience improving catalytic converters and a variety of other engine technologies. The industry, I think, unfortunately, has poor credibility on this subject, having fought seatbelts and airbags and inflating costs on catalytic converters for decades at the federal level and in California. A counterexample to the ones we heard is, in fact, the same analysts who are estimating now that the California standards will cost consumers $3,000 more per vehicle predicted 10 years ago that the new pollution standards that the industry is now touting and helping get them to 99% cleaner cars would cost $800 per vehicle. It costed $80 per vehicle. So unfortunately, I think the industry, particularly in a regulatory setting where they have no incentive to demonstrate to you that they can meet a new standard, has a poor record of predicting costs.
Thank you very much. Thank you. North Keedham, I want to talk to you. It says here, Apice Fruit, Hood River.
Apice, yes.
Okay, you say you have to leave by noon. Give us your wisdom.
Right. I'm the president and operator of Apice Fruit in Hood River. We grow 15,000 fruit trees, and I wanted to talk about the projected effects of global warming on agriculture in general and my industry, apples, pears, and peaches in particular. I have three areas of concern, and I'll be brief. Irrigation, insect cycles, and fruit tree rejuvenation over winter cold periods. Let me address each of those individually. And while I'm saying this, I want to also be clear that the effect of what I'm talking about is not so much on me personally, but on the states, the agricultural industries' impact on the state economy, which is huge. I'm not just talking about apples, pears, and peaches here. I'm talking about everything, nursery stock, turf, cherries, wheat, you name it. Each individual industry could probably come up with their own list of concerns. With my particular segment, I have isolated those three that I spoke of. First of all, let me talk about irrigation water, because everybody seems to be very, very concerned about this right now, and I'll tell you my perspective on this. We are not worried about whether we're going to get irrigation water this year, because we're on the slopes of Mount Hood. There will always be irrigation water available by glacial melt, if nothing else. The problem with glacial melt in irrigation systems is clogged filters and clogged sprinkler heads. We have several thousand sprinkler heads. We don't necessarily know if each and every one of them is working at the time we turn the irrigation on. And if they are not working, trees die. Okay? Now, in terms of filters, there's only so much you can do with that. But what I'm saying is that glacial melt is water, yes, but it's laden with silt and all kinds of particulate matter that causes immense maintenance problems in irrigation systems. Okay, that's the first thing. Second thing I'd like to address is insect cycles. Now, I don't know, I haven't heard anybody from the Forest Service here or from Forest Industries here, but I know that they also have an incredible and growing problem with pine bark beetle in forests from Montana down to New Mexico in terms of huge kills in lodgepole pine. And this is because the insect is less susceptible to the natural cycles of maturing when the cycles are affected by the prevailing temperatures. And when we're talking about just 1 or 2 degrees over historical averages, that is enough to make those insects far more virulent in terms of their effects on our national forests than they otherwise would be. In my case...
Just another minute, please. We've just got a lot of people in the room, but go ahead.
Okay, in my case, what we're talking about is an insect called coddling moth. We already have, and have for many years, been facing 2 generations of coddling moth per year. It can be devastating. Now, as we find that our temperatures warm, we can already look at the possibility of a third generation of coddling moth, which means more pesticide use. In my case, since I'm an organic grower, it would simply mean more costs associated with pheromone emitters, so forth, they'd be put out earlier. What I've seen in the last 20 years that I've been in the business is an increasingly earlier emergence of coddling moth. Last year, we had an earlier emergence of coddling moth.
And you relate that to warmer temperatures?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because what suppresses coddling moth as much as anything on a yearly basis is cold temperatures. If we can confine ourselves to two generations a year, we can generally handle this without abnormal expense. But this is the most expensive insect to control and perhaps the most devastating.
I need to ask you to wrap up in about 30 seconds, please.
Okay. The last thing, and I'll just gloss over this briefly. Fruit trees need a winter chilling requirement to change what would otherwise be vegetative buds to fruit-bearing buds. If they don't get it, you grow leaves, okay? And that is not, we're not talking about a lot of temperature change here. Just a couple of degrees is all it takes.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I think Measure 37 is the more immediate threat to the industry. How about Angus Duncan and Dr. Catherine Thomason and Rachel Lanford? I'm sorry, we only have two seats up there. So Angus Duncan and most committees we have three. So let's just bring up Angus Duncan and Dr. Thomason, please. Is Dr. Thomason here? I don't see her then. Well, let's go to Rachel Lanford. Thanks for coming this morning.
Senator Shields, thank you. My name is Angus Duncan. I'm president and CEO of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation. I am a member of the governor's advisory group on global warming and chaired its drafting committee. And sort of here in the midst of academia, I acknowledge that I'm also an adjunct research professor at Portland State University. So I can fit right in. Feels good. I was privileged during the course of the last year to serve with Jane and Mark Dodson and 25 other Oregonians on the Advisory Group for Global Warming, tasked by the governor with assessing Oregon's responsibilities to manage and reduce its greenhouse gas footprint and with devising sensible strategies for accomplishing that. The board reported unanimously to the governor on December 17th, and that report reflected general agreement on the following points, which I will just summarize. Jane's already talked at length and with great authority on the science, and I certainly don't need to compete with her there. But I would observe that that I think we agree the consequences to Oregon and to Oregonians are likely to be unacceptably severe and disruptive in all of the most plausible scientific cases that we heard, and that our progressive failure to arrest and reverse global warming will result in progressively greater and more severe consequences. This is not just a matter of a fixed set of concerns that we have to deal with, and once we've dealt with them, we're done. It's a set of concerns that will grow unless we arrest and reverse the causes. We agreed that the effects of global warming in the Northwest are going to be felt in a lot of different places, certainly in public health and agriculture and forest health, but most intensely in the water cycle. That's salmon, that's irrigated ag, that's hydroelectric production, tourism, outdoor recreation. It means more winters like the one that we're in right now. It means earlier snow melts. It means more summers with low stream flows and hotter temperatures. And we are already largely out of compliance with the EPA temperature rules in almost all of our streams. We understood that global warming is a problem of nearly overwhelming scale. It's global. It's hard. It was hard for all of the advisory group members to get their hands around this. But ultimately, we also agreed that it was a problem of our making, so it's not beyond our ability to address and to solve if we work cooperatively with other states and with other countries. We're a small state. We have a relatively small share of global emissions, although disproportionately more than our share. But if we work with the other West Coast states, hence the governor's West Coast Initiative with Governor Schwarzenegger and now Governor Gregoire, we have explored cooperation with the Northeast states that are all moving ahead on these kinds of issues as well, and also with countries with whom we do business who are signatories to the Kyoto Protocol. We understood that while some of the solutions we were looking at may add costs to households and business activities in Oregon, as many more or more of them will be money savers for Oregonians, or they will be investment opportunities that will earn positive returns for people in the state. So we need to be selective. We need to be strategic in devising our state plan, and we think that we were. We worked with very able state staff from the Department of Energy, DEQ, and others, and most interest groups in devising the 60 or so recommendations to the governor. And I just want to summarize those briefly. First, we said we need to capture at least as much energy efficiency in the next 20 years in the electrical and gas sectors as we captured in the last 20 years. It's not an over-challenging task, since we've already proved that we could do it. And not only did we prove that we could do that, it's about 1,000 average megawatts for Oregon. We proved we could do it, and we proved that we could do it and produce, you know, very substantial savings for the Northwest and the state of Oregon. You know, we invested about $2.5 billion over the last 20 years in energy conservation savings. We earn that a 100% return on that investment approximately every 24 months. It was one of the best investments we could ever have made. And we think that we will see a similar kind of return on investments in the proposed changes to auto technology. We proposed a task force to determine the feasibility of and to design a carbon allowance standard for electricity and natural gas. This is kind of a tailpipe standard for power plants. But since most of our power plants aren't in the state of Oregon, we concluded that what we had to do was figure out how to contain the carbon content of the electricity that's delivered to homes and businesses in the state of Oregon. And so we are proposing a kind of a carbon curve or a carbon allowance curve. We are proposing to try to develop this, again, in collaboration with the states of Washington and California, at least, so that we create a constraint on carbon content, but we leave it up to the utilities as to how to best and most cost-efficiently meet that constraint. But the curve is inexorable. It is also transparent. It is predictable, and it gives utilities the ability to modify their resource investment strategies over the next 45 years. That's what we think they need in order to make smart investments on our behalf. We proposed a second task force to evaluate the new California auto tailpipe emission standards, the PAVLI standards, for adoption by Oregon. Prompted by staff information and by overwhelming public testimony that suggested that the cleaner cars mandated by California would result in significant reductions in carbon emissions and produce cost savings to consumers over the life of the car, that consumer choice of vehicle styles would be largely unaffected, could even be enlarged, and that the adjustments that would be required in this case of auto manufacturers are not greater in either kind or character than what have been required of them over the last 30 or 40 years to accomplish fuel economy and emissions control standards. And we observe that with particularly the newly announced agreements between the auto manufacturers and the government of Canada, if we add which appear to be substantially similar to those that would be required of the manufacturers in California, if we add Canada to California, to Oregon and Washington, to the Northeast states that have already proposed to adopt PAVLI standards, we now have about 40% of the North American car market. It's not a niche market for automobile manufacturers, and they certainly have shown that they can design models to appeal to smaller niches than 40%. So we think it is not an uncomfortable thing for them to be required to do if the technologies are reasonable, if the cost estimates are reasonable, and that's one of the things that we want to look at in the task force. That would afford an opportunity for consumers, for businesses, for auto dealers, for manufacturers, for environmental organizations and others to advise the state government on whether Oregon should join California and these other dozen or so states, including the state of Washington, which is now considering this in their legislative process, who are either committed to or are considering adopting these more rigorous standards. This kind of a task force, Mr. Chairman, is consistent with the advisory group's intent and commitment to assure that there would be full and fair access to all interested parties in important decisions like this. We think that's important in terms of fair play, but we also think it's important that there be fair play in return. And I have to depart from my text here just to express some concerns about some of the tactics that appear to be employed or deployed by the auto manufacturers. And here I'm not talking about them taking this to federal court. You know, federal court is everybody's right. If they've got a disagreement, especially with the government, over how an action is being administered and they don't think it's being handled according to law, they ought to file a lawsuit, and they're entitled to file a lawsuit. We don't think it's fair for them to go back to D.C. and try to change the rules at the same time they're challenging the rules in court. And there was an effort in Senator Inhofe's committee to strip the state of California from the status it has had over the last 35 years of being able to adopt standards that differ from EPA auto standards. And happily, that gambit was defeated on a 7-7, or I think it was 9-9 vote in the Senate committee. But you shouldn't be going back and trying to change the rules of the game in the middle of a process. You ought to play by those rules. I'm also more than a little concerned about some of the observations that were provided in the document you received today. Most particularly, I guess, the one that says that auto manufacturers are already making vehicles today that are 99% cleaner than the vehicles from the 1970s. And I note that they qualified that by saying that means in terms of criteria pollutants. But what is distressing is the ads that they are now running that don't have that kind of qualification. It simply says it's 99% cleaner than it used to be. Autos manufactured today are virtually emission-free. And the explanation for virtually emissions-free is that, quote-unquote, CO2 is technically an emission, but it's not a pollutant. Well, you know, that's playing verbal games in the political marketplace, and I think it is unfortunate at best. Suggesting that we can't deal with the state of California on questions of developing biodiesel in the state of Oregon, I think is also highly misleading. As Jason indicated, California is not diesel averse, it is pollutant averse. And one of the great virtues of biodiesel is it has substantially lower pollutants. If there is a disagreement over this, one of the reasons the three governors process was set up is precisely to try to adjudicate these kinds of differences among the three states so that we can march consistently forward in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Now, complaining that regulations A are inflexible and B that California has altered its regulations 49 times is sort of fundamentally internally inconsistent. And this is all by way of saying that we think that the auto manufacturers and their representatives are very able and smart people. And if they're going to be participating in the task force process, we're all going to play by the rules, and we expect them to as well. Mr. Chairman, I will conclude with the last, but in some ways perhaps the most important thing that the advisory group did, and that was to propose that Oregon adopt carbon emissions reduction standards goals that are comparable to those that are being adopted and worked toward by many other states in this country and by most of the countries of the world. The signatories to the now in effect Kyoto Protocol. And it is worth noting in this regard that most of Oregon's major trading partners, Canada, Japan, the European Union countries, and others, are signers of the Kyoto Protocol, and we've seen a number of instances in which they have telegraphed their expectation that that they do not expect their trade with the United States to be adversely affected or disadvantaged because they're observing carbon reduction standards and we are not. Oregon currently has a benchmark for CO2 emissions. It's that we should not exceed 1990 levels. We're about 18% above 1990 levels as of the last time it was measured. So the advisory group did not propose that we meet 1990 levels by 2010. That didn't seem realistic, but what we did say is we want to enact enough of these and implement enough of these measures so we take the line which has been trending upward for the last 10, 15 years and turn it so it's finally trending downward again. That's ambitious, but it's doable. By 2020, we want to be able to catch up with the other countries and states and be 10% below 1990 levels. And by 2050, long time out, but again, we need to telegraph what's expected so that businesses and people can adjust. We need to be at least 75% below 1990 levels. Those are consistent with the science. We think they're consistent with what is doable by people in the state of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Duncan. Thanks also for your great work on the task force.
Thank you.
Any questions, Senator Shields? Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Lanford.
Senator Ringo and Senator Shields, thank you very much for this opportunity. And my name is Rachel Langford. I'm here with the American Lung Association of Oregon. I'm the Clean Air Programs Coordinator for that organization. And the American Lung Association of Oregon is the oldest public health nonprofit in Oregon, founded in 1915. Our mission is to prevent lung disease and promote lung health, which is exactly why I'm here today to talk with you about the possibility of bringing California's low-emission vehicle standards here to Oregon. And we believe that these new standards will go a long way in improving the air quality in Oregon, improving the air that Oregonians breathe, and therefore will have great impacts on public health. And this is especially significant for our most vulnerable populations, and we consider those to be children, the elderly, people with underlying lung disease, people with cardiovascular disease, and also healthy adults who live, work, and play outside, which we have a lot of that here in Oregon.
Ms. Lanford, I'd like you to just answer a couple questions for me.
Sure.
If we adopt California's vehicle emission standards, that impacts the CO2. What other elements does it impact? Well, what other types of chemicals or particulates are coming out that would be impacted?
Well, it would impact ozone levels, and as you probably know, ozone isn't something that's directly emitted from tailpipes but is created in the atmosphere.
Right.
Particle pollution and toxic air pollutants.
And those particulates are the contributors to asthmas and lung cancers?
Yes,
okay.
As well as ozone.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead and continue.
Okay. And I just want to talk briefly about these risk groups. We have approximately 723,000 children under the age of 14. These are a sensitive group because children's lungs are still forming, and children also take in more air for their body size, and so they're breathing at a more rapid rate. We have 452,000 adults over the age of 65. The elderly generally are experiencing decreased lung function, perhaps some immune deficiencies as well, so they are also a sensitive group. We've got, with children and adults, over 300,000 Oregonians suffering with asthma. And as you know, asthma is a disease, a chronic disease, where airways are hyperreactive and very susceptible to being triggered by a variety of environmental pollutants. And also over 112,000 adults with heart disease. And a new group that the American Lung Association nationally has added this year to their risk group would be people with diabetes, because there's a link there between diabetics and heart disease. And then also, and I don't have a statistic for this, but the many Oregonians with chronic bronchitis and emphysema. And so bringing the LEV2 standards to Oregon will not only improve life for these sensitive populations, but it will also reduce the dangerous emissions of gases that contribute to ozone, as I explained, particle pollution, carbon monoxide, and toxic air pollutants. And I'd like to tell you more about these specific pollutants and explain why the American Lung Association is asking you to take steps to reduce them.
You know, I just want, we have the written testimony, and I just given the length of the people on a sign-up sheet, if you, sorry about that. This isn't recorded, is it? If you could just wrap it up in a couple minutes, that'd be great.
Absolutely. So ozone, I have a statistic here from the DEQ that says that motor vehicles are responsible for a third of the ozone pollution in the Portland metro area. Ozone is, of course, smog. I think something that's important to note about ozone is it's kind of like a sunburn for your lungs. You think about one exposure, one sunburn, and it heals and it's fine. But imagine getting a sunburn every single day. It causes substantial tissue damage and can impact, especially in children, the development of their lungs and contribute to decreased lung function and even the risk of dying early. There's a significant body of evidence that shows that. And we talk a lot about the standards and the criteria pollutants and being in attainment here in Oregon, but there are studies also that show that even when we are not, even though we do not exceed the standard in ozone, in many cases, researchers have found an increased risk of premature death associated with increased levels of ozone that are within the federal standard. I think it's important to note that ozone is not just an urban problem. I think that people believe that this is, if they live outside of the Portland area, then they're not exposed to ozone because of the way it forms. We found that in the summertime, the highest ozone in the state is measured just south of Oregon City, so there are rural communities that are impacted by ozone.
I really need you to wrap up in a couple minutes.
Okay. And I guess most crucially, particle pollution shortens lives. That's something that's come to light very recently with a lot of new research. And I guess I'll just say I'll give one brief example and then conclude. I think when we talk about air pollution and asthma, people think about asthma a lot. We have in 1996 in Atlanta, they had the city reroute a lot of the individual vehicle travel, and in 2 weeks, in the 2 weeks of the Olympic Games when there was not individual vehicle travel within the city, it was just public transportation, they saw a 42% decrease in asthma events, a 28% decrease in ozone levels. So that shows that link pretty clearly. And we have clear scientific evidence that air pollution from vehicle exhaust harms the people of Oregon. And though we've taken a lot of good steps to clean up Oregon's air, we still have an air that makes far too many people sick. And we have our neighbors to the south and our neighbors to the north that are taking steps, important steps, to protect the most vulnerable among us by going that extra mile and asking for more progressive vehicle standards for their residents. And we believe at the Lung Association that Oregonians deserve the same chance to breathe cleaner air and lead healthier, more productive lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Senator Shields, any questions?
No, but thank you. It was good testimony.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. Is Gail Ackerman here? I thought I saw her sneak out. Okay. Let's go to Steve Schell and Mitch Rosky, please.
I'm Steve Schell, and I was for 3 years the chairman of the board and president of the Energy Trust of Oregon, and I provided testimony regarding this report. In that capacity, I served on the global warming task force that the governor created. However, I am no longer in that position, so I'm not testifying on behalf of the Energy Trust at this point because I have resigned from the board, not because I think the board is doing anything properly, but there are other things that I need to do right now. In any case, I'm really pleased that you came to Portland. You can say you can, you know, move the mountain to Mohammed, and that's kind of what you've done here. And it's a great effort that the Senate has taken to go out to the constituencies rather than having everybody come to Salem. I really appreciate that. Let me say that I'm very much supportive of Senate Bill 344 to move it forward at this time. And the reason for that is the evidence that was provided to us on the task force, on the advisory committee, was conclusive in terms of the impact. I'm particularly concerned about electricity. But if you don't make electricity work with fossil fuel emissions from other sources, you're never going to solve the problem. It's a combination of activity. So even though the electricity is a significant producer of global warming gases in Oregon, there is still very much a necessity to take care of auto emissions and vehicle emissions in order to make it all work together. We're not going to solve this problem overnight. The fact is that we have to make a long-term commitment in order to change the way we do business. That's a very hard thing to do. It's very easy to take activity out of the out years and put it off to somebody else's watch. But in this situation, we don't have much choice. We have to act now in order to change events 20, 50 years from now. So I urge you to pay attention to the advisory committee report, to see it in conjunction with other things that are going on, and take this step in support of Senate Bill 344 at this time. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mr. Shell. I appreciate your comment that we better take action now if we want to impact where we are 20, 30, 40 years out. So thank you. Senator Shields.
Thank you for coming, Bill.
Mitch Roski.
Senator Ringo, thank you for inviting me. I hope you remember that we talked about this 2 years ago. I'm president and CEO of Better World Club. We're the nation's greener auto club. We provide roadside assistance throughout the country, as well as other services. And obviously, I'm here to in support of the legislation. We do things like provide discounts on for our memberships on hybrid rental cars, and even more interesting, we surcharge gas guzzlers. And just as an aside, I also worked in the 1970s. I worked with Ralph Nader before he became a politician, and worked on airbag legislation and saw exactly what it took and how much resistance there was to that, and just how, in fact, despite the resistance, these technologies do get adapted in cost-effective ways. We have followed the we were the only auto club to endorse the Pavley legislation, have followed it closely through California. We're thrilled that you're proposing what you're proposing, and I will be very brief because the environmental groups have already gone into detail about exactly what the impact of global warming is and how it impacts the health of Oregon's environments as well as the health of its citizens. But for us, we're less concerned about the specific calibration of harm. What we're concerned about is this: that business should not use our skies and waterways as free public toilets. That basically, they also shouldn't produce products to do so.
We've got some other bills you could testify on.
I'd be happy to. Basically, what we feel is that whether it's the auto industry or any other industry regarding greenhouse gas emissions, is if you make the mess, you should clean it up. And I want to make the specific point that one of the representatives just a little while ago of the auto industry said that it's the marketplace that should be left to clean up the mess, that really nothing should be done. And I just want to say how much I want to express just how wrong I think that statement is. The fact of the matter is that the marketplace doesn't clean up environmental issues. I mean, if you were to talk about it as an economist, you would say that pollution is an externality, and when an externality is costless, you're going to have more of it. And unless a means is devised, and there are lots of theories we could talk about that, about how you would devise an economy that did penalize for pollution, but until we have that kind of economy, then we're very dependent on government regulation to do something about it. The only other thing that I'd like to say, because you can read my testimony, is that this is not the end-all for auto regulation, and certainly I'd like you to consider a couple other steps as you're thinking about this. One is that we'd like you to consider the establishment of greenhouse gas targets for all transportation fuels sold in Oregon. And here I want to associate myself with the comments of the representatives of the auto industry. We do quite a bit with biodiesel, and we're very interested in biodiesel. It's kind of surprising that California isn't open to that as well, and I would certainly like you to take a look at that. I would hope that there are some exemptions could be made around this legislation if it's going to impede biodiesel in any way. Finally, we'd like you to consider requiring all passenger vehicles to disclose the amount of greenhouse gas emissions on a vehicle window sticker, much like the fuel economy stickers. And we understand that would enable informed consumers to make more intelligent vehicle choices. If it's not possible to do this on the state level, we would like your support to encourage Oregon's representatives in Congress to support this idea. And with that, I thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rothke. Your testimony is on letterhead Better World Club, and you mentioned that's an environmentally friendly roadside assistance service. So if somebody has AAA right now, they could get roadside assistance through Better World.
Well, you know, I was going to mention that in my testimony, but because of time, I didn't. But I appreciate your mentioning it.
And what would the website be?
It's www.betterworldclub.com.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thank
Senator
you.
Shields, do you have any questions?
I wrote it down.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Just to the audience, I have probably, I don't know, at least I'd say 20 people that are still signed up to testify. I am one who appreciates lunch, and I think this would be a good time to take it. I did have a note from Ken Ray. He said, is he here or is he already? Why don't you come up and give us the – you're an opponent, so you can give the parting shot on that note when we go to lunch.
I appreciate that.
And give us the three-minute summary on why you're opposed to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Ray. I live in Clackamas. And I am not paid to be here. In fact, I forfeited part of my day salary to be here because I do believe in this issue. So I do appreciate the venue.
Mr. Ray, I appreciate your public participation.
Okay. I am opposed. I'm in the auto industry. My job is a fleet sales manager. I sell to businesses and commercial accounts for a local large Dodge dealer. And I do have some observations which are based on my real-world experiences with the California Air Resources Board. Unlike many of the testimony I've heard, I plan to speak specifically about this bill, and my problem with this bill is the California Air Resources Board and how it actually administers emission law, how it limits consumer choice, and in fact many times ends up at cross-purposes with its what its stated goals are. Give you an example. We sell a highly efficient, very clean-burning vehicle that runs on diesel called the Dodge Sprinter. It's an ultra-low-emission vehicle in Europe, meets the most stringent standards, but for 2 years, California buyers were not allowed the opportunity to purchase that vehicle. It didn't meet some of their bureaucratic requirements, and the consumers in New York, Massachusetts, and Maine also lost out because of this. This is a commercial van that gets about twice the mileage, fuel mileage, of the typical van on the road. It gets 23 to 25 miles per gallon, but that opportunity was not afforded the citizens of California. I am disturbed with Oregon tying itself to those standards. You know, like many mandates, people like them to apply to others, not to themselves. People say they want better mileage, but the reality is you can't put a family of five or seven in a vehicle that gets 50 miles per gallon. Physics gets in the way. No matter what your efficiency is of your gasoline engine, it's still only 120,000 BTUs per gallon. You can't make more energy come out of it. And it reminds me of in 1897 when the Indiana legislature came close to passing a law that would have required pi to be rounded off to 3 because it was an ungainly number. And although the law didn't pass, the point is you can't legislate laws of physics or mathematics into place. And this is about fuel mileage. The automakers are correct. This is a backdoor attempt to regulate fuel economy, which is a province not allowed the states. Only Congress can do that. So, again, this is really, really about not so much CO2, but fuel mileage. Speaking to two things that I heard, about 12 years ago, California Air Resources Board decided that automakers would have to sell a certain percentage of zero-emission vehicles in the state. They said, oh, you can do it. Well, the deadline came. They had to rescind, or they called it postpone the rule, but it's an indefinite postponement. And, you know, ironically, it was electric-powered vehicles that met that rule. It generated more greenhouse gases, unless it's nuclear or hydroelectric. They generate more greenhouse gases than the vehicles themselves would have burned, in my opinion. The other thing to address, the thing about pollution index on sticker vehicles, that's actually been in place since the 2004 model year. I'd like that for informational purposes. You'll notice there's a establishment called the Pollution Index. You can also look it up online at the Environmental Protection Agency's fuelmileage.gov website, and it is already a requirement. So some of the person's wishes have come true already at the behest of
just
the federal
government.
Just
a couple more minutes.
Yes. I'm actually basically done. Okay. I spoke quicker and less detailed than I wanted to because I realize you're trying to limit testimony. But the last thing is that unless the advocates of this law, and I'm not just speaking to the members of the committee, unless they intend to prohibit larger families or regulate the amount of vehicle that can people that can be in a vehicle, I see no way that you can always force fuel mileage standards and not also take consumer choice and consumer preference into the equation. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Now, I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Ray. You know, when you heard from Dr. Lubchenco, you heard from one of the world-renowned scientists on global warming.
I'm not disputing her.
You're not disputing that at all.
Not at all, and I'm not even going to get into the philosophical part of it.
It
is purely the California Air Resources Board and Oregon tying itself to those standards.
That's fine. I mean, you agree that our government needs to get involved in a pretty serious way to address the global warming issue. You don't have a quarrel with that, do you?
I may. I'm not an expert on it, okay. And I'm not...
You'll defer to the experts?
Well, I'll defer to the experts,
okay.
But I have, you know... I don't want to get into that at this panel.
That's
I'm purely to the bill on this one.
I'm not a scientist either. Thank you, Mr. Ray. I really appreciate your testimony.
Okay.
Senator Shields, do you have any?
No questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
This recesses the hearing, and right now I have 5 after 12. I don't know how quick you can get a sandwich around here. I'm going to see if we can get back in about a half hour. Thanks very much. Senate Committee on the Environment and Land Use. To those in the audience, I just want to say that we've heard a lot of detailed testimony this morning, and I want to give everybody who's signed up the chance to testify, and so that may mean people will have to keep their comments relatively brief, but that's just one of the trade-offs we make. And so I'll just go right down the list. Fred Hoyt? Is Casey here? I don't see him. Oh, there. I'm sorry. Okay. Why don't you're next then, Casey.
Invite him up to the other chair.
That's fine.
Mr. Chairman, members, the member of the committee, Fred Hewitt from the Sierra Club. Thanks for having me testify. Provide a written testimony, which I won't read. In 1989, I was privileged to appear before a predecessor committee in support of Senate Bill 578, which led to passage of law that had Oregon doing the first, to my knowledge, first state-level study of global climate change. At that time, we felt that it was important to learn more about the issue, and it was probably premature to take any major actions. In the meantime, we've learned a great deal about the issue, and now we feel it's time to take significant action. Oregon has a climate response, a set of climate response policies that I think are very admirable, and now is the time to start moving ahead to make sure that we actually carry through on what we know we need to do. I won't review all the features of the covered by previous people who testified here. I do want to draw your attention to the handout included with my testimony that describes the Canadian agreement that was reached this week with the auto industry. We feel this is a very important new development. It reflects for the first time a positive statement by the industry about what they can do and not what they can't do. And we feel this is going to make a major change in how this whole issue is actually perceived and addressed. The Canadians have been negotiating with the auto industry for some time in the context of their adoption of the Kyoto Protocol, which has just gone into effect last month. And so they are very serious about dealing with the issue of transportation emissions, or greenhouse gas emissions, and have reached the details not yet formally official, but generally speaking, very similar in scope to the Padley law in California and the same thing that we're considering here as Senate Bill 344. So I simply wanted to point that out as a very important new development, and we encourage this committee and the Senate, the legislature, and our governor to pass Senate Bill 344. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Fred. Appreciate your work, and that is an interesting development in Canada. Casey Golden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, my name is K.C. Golden. I'm the Policy Director for Climate Solutions. We work on practical and profitable solutions to global warming in the four Northwest states and British Columbia. And you've heard today about how most of the rest of the advanced industrial world is now mobilizing under the Kyoto Treaty to begin to solve this problem, about how many U.S. states and cities are participating as well. And I think what that reflects is not only a growing recognition of the truth of what Dr. Lubchenco said this morning, that it's an absolute environmental necessity to do this, but also that within that environmental necessity is an extraordinary economic opportunity, that the transition from a relatively primitive fossil fuel-based inefficient energy system to an efficient system based on clean energy technologies is perhaps the greatest economic opportunity of our generation. And I think what you're beginning to see is, while some folks are doing it to respond to the environmental imperative, more and more countries and cities and states and companies are getting on board because they're sort of a crossroads, because they know that the more that they prolong their dependence on fossil fuels, the further they fall behind economically as the world makes this transition to clean energy sources. I was privileged to participate in a collaborative process in Washington over the last year, parallel to the one that Angus Duncan described here in Washington. Our results were very comparable as well. I won't talk about that whole process or all of its results, except to say just a little bit about why clean car standards emerged at the very top of our list of recommendations. And this stakeholder group included many of Washington's most prominent businesses, Boeing and Weyerhaeuser and BP Arco and others, as well as a good cross-section of public sector and public interest representatives. The reason that the clean car standards emerged overwhelmingly as a top priority for this entire group were first and foremost because of the environmental benefits that you've heard described here today, and because of they are really the single biggest thing a state can do that's squarely within state jurisdiction to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the largest source in our states. By the way, Jason's figures about how much motor vehicles contribute nationally, of course, they're a much bigger proportion of our emissions here in the Northwest because we have relatively little from our electric base, although still a significant amount. But in addition to the environmental benefits, the global warming benefits, the air toxics benefits, this single action delivered more economic benefit than any other item that we looked at. Oregon right now exports about $10 million a day for petroleum and natural gas. That's money spent on those fuels that goes straight out of the state, doesn't stop for any economic use or to create any job in Oregon. It either goes to refineries in Washington or it goes to Houston or Alaska or Riyadh, but it doesn't stay in Oregon where it would be creating more economic activity and jobs here. This is the single biggest thing we can do to plug that gap, that hole in our economic bucket in the Northwest, and begin to return some of that economic promise to our states in the form of investments in biodiesel, clean energy, more efficient appliances and cars and those sorts of things. The other reason I think that people felt it was so powerfully positive from an economic perspective, particularly the utilities and the big manufacturers that participated, is that they realized that our air is increasingly a finite resource and that we will in the future live in a carbon-constrained world, as the rest of the world does, with the West Coast governors now contemplating targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And we need to allocate that air resource in the way that best fits our local economy. And if we inadvertently allocate most of it to cars, in effect, what we're doing is taking it away from local businesses and local jobs that also need to live with that same air shed. Our utilities and manufacturers know that they will be called upon to be part of the solution to any air quality problem or to global warming. The question now is, will the automakers do their share, or will our local businesses have to bear the entire responsibility for meeting these goals? That's part of the reason it's so important economically. Jason did a terrific job this morning describing the consumer benefits and why the vast majority of consumers will save money from day one of purchasing the new cleaner vehicles. I will just say we are in the legislative process in Washington. There's been a lot of back and forth on this issue. I will say this is not a he said, she said deal. You're going to hear some alternative numbers, but what we have the benefit of is that California went through the most exhaustive rulemaking and evidentiary process I've ever seen on any issue to arrive at the numbers that Jason showed you this morning. So when you see alternative numbers, remember that those numbers were considered in the California process, and that by law, under California law, the new greenhouse gas standards must be economical to consumers and must not reduce model availability or consumer choice. So, and California made darn sure that they met that standard by a very wide margin because they knew that they'd be sued and they'd have to defend it. So that's all on the record, and I hope you'll look closely at that record as you move forward. I'll conclude with that and just say that, you know, sometimes I know that in your role you are called upon to make difficult trade-offs between environmental values and economic values. Sometimes we tend to think of the world in terms of that trade-off. This is not one of those cases. This is an opportunity to do something for Oregon that has very powerful and necessary economic benefits, but also that demonstrably puts money back in Oregonians' pockets and helps make this a more healthy, prosperous, economically vital state. Thank you very much for taking this issue up. I'd welcome any questions. I know you've got a lot of people behind me.
Well, I just appreciate your coming down to Oregon, and good luck with the battle up in Washington.
Thanks very much. You know, I should say that we are somewhat interdependent on this. Washington is moving forward, and I'm optimistic that we'll get there. It's clearly more effective to the extent that we ultimately form a West Coast market that joins with the Canadian market and the Northeast market to really leverage the big changes in the whole vehicle market. So I hope we can move together.
I hope so, too. Mm.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Glenn Spain and Jared Kahn. Is Jared here? Do you want to come up as well, please?
Okay, well, all right. Well.
My name is Glenn Spain. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, PCFFA. We are the West Coast's largest organization of commercial fishermen and fishing families. Many of our members, and we are a coastwide organization, many of our members are in the salmon fishery, and we have also fair experience with ocean conditions, and many of our people also participate in ocean monitoring and other programs. I want to support the bill. We've, in general, as an organization, supported any effort to reduce global warming for a variety of reasons. These impacts are hitting us now. They are hitting us today. And all the projections that are available to us are that things will get very much worse for ocean marine species that are vitally important to the economies of many coastal import communities, including throughout the Northwest and up into British Columbia. I'm distributing a number of just very recent articles. This is very timely. For instance, you'll note that the salmon runs in the Fraser River are now collapsing. The runs up there are facing record or near-record water temperatures. These are linked by recent reports of the Canadian government to global climate change. The costs to the fishing industry in that region will be astronomical, and these also are costs that are transported to U.S. fisheries because under the Pacific Salmon Treaty, many of those fish would be available to harvest in the U.S. However, that fishery, which is the number two salmon fishery, only behind the Columbia River, the number two in North America, is collapsing. And global warming is clearly implicated in that collapse. We have problems throughout the region, including reduced snowpack that changes the hydrology of river systems. Many of our river systems in Oregon are not in compliance with EPA and state standards on water quality and water temperature in particular. The habitat areas that salmon have available to them are gradually shrinking. That's been well documented. That's aside from watershed impacts such as drying forests and additional impacts on fire hazard, which is outside of my expertise but clearly is an issue. We have ocean migration shifts. Essentially, what we've seen in the last few decades is an increasing number and an increasing severity of El Nino events. Ocean conditions are changeable. They do change, but they change around a mean. And if you look at the history over the last 100 or 150 years, you'll find that those means are changing. If you look at the current last three decades, you'll find that El Ninos happen more frequently with more severity than in the prior part of the last century. We are also now documenting increases in ocean temperature worldwide. There are now international monitoring systems that have been in place for some time. The fact that the ocean itself, the largest heat sink in the world, can change over time is an indication that there is something seriously wrong and the climate impacts are having dramatic impacts. Remember, these are ocean ecosystems that have not varied for millions of years. The species that are there are dependent on a very narrow range of temperatures. We have temperature now ranging in areas which are killing off coral beds, which are nursery areas for many fisheries worldwide. We are seeing an increased acidity in the ocean as carbon dioxide is put into the air. Some of it is dissolved in seawater. That increases the acidity. These are also environments used to and evolved for a very narrow range, and we're pushing the upper limits in some of those ranges. We are seeing a noticeable increase in average sea levels. What that means, it may seem insignificant that we may have a few inches change in the last 30 years, but a few inches translates to a loss of coastal wetlands on the order of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of acres of coastal wetlands. More than half of the fish species that are harvested in the West Coast are wetlands-dependent species. For part of their life cycle, they depend on those wetlands that are gradually disappearing as they're inundated with salt water. Likewise, salmon depend on those wetland areas in the estuaries, and the estuaries are flooding more frequently with salt water and further up, and there's very little effort to adapt to those things. These are things that are happening now, and all of the projections with increased global warming is that those things will get worse in the future. These are costing us money. These are industries that are dependent on these ecological systems. That is our bread and butter. That is how we make our living. That has produced tens of thousands of jobs in a multi-billion dollar industry. That resource is now eroding, largely because of climate change. The other problem, of course, is we're seeing an increased severity of storm events. That, of course, concerns our industry. It's one of the most dangerous in the world, and we don't need to add any more lost lives to that problem. Port infrastructures are starting to erode in ways that are unmistakably linked to increased sea levels. There's also very little funding left in the federal budget, and much of the funding has been pulled in the federal budget to improve those port infrastructures. Seawalls are crumbling in a variety of areas, and there's no money to fix them.
Just another couple minutes, please.
I've passed out something that is alarming to us, and that's the Fraser River. I'd like that to be part of the record for the hearing. And also note that there is a recent coverage of a report looking at specifically the impacts on the salmon industry and salmon ecology as a result of projecting some of these things into the future. This bill is part of the solution, clearly. I'd also note that there are occasionally objections, you hear them often, that this will damage the economy. Well, the economy of Japan, I note from the Union for Concerned Scientists, generates one-fifth our CO2. And you certainly can't say that they're not a number one economic dynamo, particularly in the Asian market. Germany generates even less. And again, this is a booming economy. Time and time again, economies have proven that conserving and making better use of waste products, and that's all that unburned gasoline and CO2 is a waste product, conserving and making more efficient use generates jobs. And I would submit that in the long run, we have a lot to lose if we don't do our part to make this problem manageable. We have literally hundreds of millions of dollars of infrastructure and port economies at risk.
Just wrap it up in a minute, please.
That's basically it. I'd be happy to take any questions. We do support the bill, and in general, we support all similar efforts.
Okay. Thank you very much. I had a question about rising temperatures in rivers. Is that because there's just less snow flowing into the river, or does it have to do with warm effluents from, say, the wastewater facilities, storm water that's too warm?
Your bill dealing with inflows.
The toxin mixing zones.
Yeah, mixing zones. That's something also that we support. It's a different issue. In this case, we're dealing with overall climate change. That means greater temperature of the ambient air, which translates to greater water temperature, exacerbated by the change of hydrology that puts less water in during the warmest months. And as you know, it takes a lot less energy to boil a small cup of water than a large one.
That's right. Thank you, Senator Fields. Okay,
no,
thank you.
Thank you for sharing.
Thank
Eric
you.
Kahn, you both came from more than 100 miles. That's why I wanted you to come. Well, that's why it was checked. So.
Oh, I might have checked the wrong box.
Well, back at NOAA.
I yield to him.
I apologize.
Go ahead.
I might have checked the wrong box on that one. I'm Jared Kahn. I'm a law school student at Lewis and Clark University, and I'm a member of the Northwest Environmental Defense Center. Thank you, Senators, for doing this bill. I must say I always am curious to opponents of friendly environmental bills. I think their motivations always need to be questioned. And in this case, it seems like the auto manufacturers' motivations are profits, and they're scared that they will be threatened. Aside from that, there's two parts to Senate Bill 344, the LEV2 program and the CO2 reduction program. Right now, what we believe what may be necessary for Oregon's success would be to implement the LEV2 program now and maybe hold off on the contentious CO2 update and maybe wait till the next session of Congress. Right now, it is unchallengeable for the LEV2 program to be implemented. The Auto Alliance has already lost in federal courts all over the nation in this, and that they cannot challenge this standard. Right now, obviously, we've heard testimony about them trying to challenge a CO2 standard. The only problem about waiting to implement the LEV2 standards or the CO2 program is that the composition of the Senate in 2007 is unknown, and the control of the House and the control of the Senate is a big part of why this is a big deal right now. I know we're all scared that the House will turn this bill down is kind of what the talk is, and I do want to address what is now also a recent comment by the governor. He said that he supports this legislation, but he's afraid of litigation. And to me, you guys are our legislatures, and it's part of your job to probably not be afraid of legislation that you want to do and your policies. It's also part of your job to get sued for some of your legislations. And it's understandable people have their rights infringed, but it's not to let fear overcome what your successful program could be is, to me, a mistake. And, you know, right now in California, they're facing problems, which may or may not be defeated. But at least the LEV2 program cannot be defeated in court, and there's no problem with that. The automakers have already lost their fight to stop basic clean car standards, just as they lost their fight against seatbelts, airbags, and fuel efficiency standards. They fight with tooth and nail, and they lose, and then they come out saying we're the good guys and that we provide these great airbags, although at first they never wanted to give it to us. I think there's been a lot of testimony on the benefits, the monetary benefits. There was commentary about limiting consumer choice, and I decided I didn't make copies, but I'm going to go ahead and submit this, and I spoke to Matt, and he said he'll make copies. These are the exact same cars. Any car you can think of right now on the road, they're in here, and they're under LEV2 standards in these other states, or if not ultra-low vehicle emission standards. These other eight states get these same exact cars. They get their Ford F-250 pickup, extra heavy-duty ton cars. You get your Hummers, but you get it with a low vehicle emission. Why can't Oregon have the exact same demand? We've let now, for a long time, auto manufacturers to control our choices for the cars we buy, and now it's time for consumers to have some power, and it's also time for legislatures to listen to what we want as well. You guys have control in forcing them to give what our demands are.
I wish we did have that control, by the way.
Yeah. Well, you can almost have that control if we implement this LEV program.
Okay.
I don't think we should have to drive around without clear consciences knowing that we are polluting our environment just because a few auto manufacturers are scared of change and scared of putting some money down. They're already making the cleaner cars. They're already on the shelf. They're already on the roads. And there's no reason why these can't be brought to Oregon. Like I said before, if we wait a couple more years, it will just push the 2009 goal further down the line. If we implement it now, there's enough ample time for the manufacturers to have years of preparation and to be able to adjust to these demands. If we wait till 2007, it'll just make them say this is not enough time, and they'll say let's do it in 2011, and there's no reason to push this back any further. We can do this now, and it's, you know, obviously we all have heard the scares of global warming. We might as well address this now. And I'm just trying to see. I have a lot of other things to say, but we've already talked about a lot of this today. A lot of people have already brought up these other facts. But I would like you to take a look at all these cars. Every single one we drive today is a low vehicle emission in other states.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Kahn. Excuse me. Senator Shields wants to grill you for a second.
Go for it.
Actually, I'm not going to grill you. I'm going to make two quick comments. The first one is that I do drive around with a clear conscience every day. In 2000, I bought a Honda Insight Hybrid. I now have 64,000 miles on it, and in that 64,000 miles, I've averaged 63.2 miles per gallon. Okay. Number two, I'm ready to vote for Senate Bill 344 anytime, any place we have an official hearing that's ready to do so.
I'm glad. I hope that we can convince the House to do the same. I know it is.
Well, go take on the House.
That's yeah. I know you guys support
And I could give you some places to move to and then run for the legislature.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good luck. Good luck in law school. Chris Hagenbaumer. Thanks for waiting, Chris.
Good afternoon, Chair Ringo and Senator Shields. My name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm a program director at the Oregon Environmental Council, and I've got written testimony that I will abbreviate greatly. One thing that to mention is that Department of Energy has looked at what is transportation's contribution to global warming here in Oregon, and it's the second largest source, CO2 emissions at 38% in 2000. So it's bigger than the national average, not quite as high as Washington State's, but definitely we have got to address mobile source pollution if we're going to address global warming in Oregon. I wanted to mention that the advisory group has several different transportation recommendations, strategies that relate to legislation that's being considered this session. So I'll digress momentarily to say that the advisory group has recommended that Oregon integrate land use and transportation decisions with greenhouse gas consequences. So there are some bills that are coming your way this session that, well, as an example, House Bills 2458 and 2549 would undermine our land use planning system, both passed by large margins in the House, and I hope that you're able to stop them in the Senate. Basically, sprawl induces traffic. Traffic releases greenhouse gases. In fact, every additional vehicle mile traveled generates approximately 1 pound of carbon dioxide. So please, when you're thinking about land use this session, consider the greenhouse gas impacts. The second, given that OEC is the lead group on promoting biodiesel legislation this session, I did want to mention that biodiesel has a profoundly fewer carbon dioxide emissions than regular petroleum diesel, and I wanted to explain why. Plant-based fuels have what's called a closed carbon cycle, which means that the carbon dioxide released when they're burned is later used by the plants, which are then used as feedstock to produce more biodiesel. In contrast, when you burn petroleum fuel, it releases carbon dioxide that's been stored for millions of years. And plants can recycle some of this, but very little. And although the earlier speakers noted that there are some diesel cars that are not allowed in California, that has really nothing to do with the biodiesel legislation being considered this session. Firstly, it's heavy-duty engines that are the primary market for biodiesel, home heating oil, heavy-duty trucks, so on and so forth. And secondly, as was mentioned by Jason Mark, auto manufacturers who are producing diesel vehicles will eventually produce ones that will be clean enough for the California market and for the other states that have adopted the California tailpipe standards. There are, I believe, four major reasons why Senate Bill 344 should be supported. The first is climate protection, which you've heard plenty about. The second is healthier air, and I did want to mention, I think Rachel would have told us a little bit more about some of the air toxics that are in our air. The California LEV II ZEV standards reduce by about 25% four chemicals that have been shown to cause cancer, benzene, 1,3-butadiene, formaldehyde, and acetaldehyde, all of which are in our air at levels way higher than human health benchmarks. We have got to deal with air toxics.
Chris, I should have saved this question for Rachel, I guess, but what type of cancers are we talking about? Are they lung cancer, or are they... Jason is nodding yes.
Yes, Senator Ringo and Senator Shields, I believe that it's mostly lung cancers, but we're also, I believe, talking about other types of cancers as well. I mean, but maybe someone else here has more expertise than I.
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead.
So basically, one point I wanted to make is that by adopting California's tailpipe standards, even if the federal courts overturn the greenhouse gas emissions segment of the California's tailpipe standards, we will get cleaner air that we desperately need here in Oregon. The other thing is consumer choice, which you've already heard a lot about, and fuel cost savings, which you've already heard about. Earlier, Mr. Cosgrove said that, you know, unfortunately, consumers are choosing heavier cars and trucks. To me, that's precisely the reason why we need these tailpipe standards, because then those heavier cars and trucks will be both cleaner as well as spewing fewer global warming gases. That's basically what I had to say.
That's great. Thank you very much, Chris.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure.
Oliver Smith? Mike Unger?
My name is Mike Unger, and I'm a leader of the Engineers for Global Responsibility. The purpose of our group is to advocate for legislation that addresses mitigation of global warming. And we believe strongly in the advocating, working with the legislature to set up rules and laws that will encourage our citizens to become active in this endeavor. One of the reasons that I've been mostly concerned about this is it relates to carbon dioxide, and we've heard how that has increased. If you look at the readings that were taken at, in Hawaii related to concentrations of carbon dioxide, we see that in when that first started in 1959, for the five-year period there, the average increase was 0.9 parts per million. During the most recent five-year period, the average annual increase was 1.8 parts per million. And the most recent year is 3 parts per million. And the idea of, you know, this exponential increase pointed out by that 3 parts per million is, to me, rather chilling. We may soon reach the 450 or 500 parts per million that scientists have discussed as coming about. We're now at 380. Even if you stay with 1.8 parts per million increase per year, we could be up to 450 in about 30 years. We're concerned about the possible world that our children and grandchildren may face. My personal experience career here has been with the electric utility business, and I'm very much aware of the feasibility of wind farms and how through government action, through government legislation, we could encourage wind farms. There are some obstacles to transmission and getting the wind power from the farm to the market. But I guess I just think that's another example of how we can pass legislation to encourage industry to address global warming. We strongly support Measure 344. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the support of the Engineers for Global Responsibility. That's wonderful. Roy Shearer.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, my name is Roy Shearer, for the record. I'm a student at Willamette University, and I've done a fair amount of work on Senate Bill 344 for the Oregon State Senate. And there are a couple issues that, actually just one issue in particular that I wanted to address. I've spoken with Senator Rockefeller's office of the Washington State Senate, who is the chief sponsor of some of the, pretty much the same bill in Washington State. And one of the issues that was brought up to me from his office was an issue from the auto dealers in the state of Washington. Apparently, there's a great deal of auto trading along the I-5 corridor in between Washington and Oregon and California and Oregon as well, and also from California to Washington. One of the difficulties in not having a similar standard along the West Coast in terms of vehicle emissions requirements is that it makes auto trading across the West Coast very difficult, which is a very common practice of auto dealers. And so this is one of the issues I wanted to bring up for the committee.
You're talking about new vehicles?
Yes, in the newer vehicles.
So some dealer in San Francisco might want to ship 50-100 vehicles, whatever, up to Oregon or Washington, and a common standard would help.
Essentially they can't really trade because of the emission standards. So
okay.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, are you here on behalf of the auto dealers?
No, I can't say that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Sure. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Michael Lang.
Good afternoon. I have a report related to fog water deposition that I'd like to give to the committee. I already shared it with Senator Shields only because he was closest and I couldn't find you. Thanks for the opportunity to comment on air quality issues in Oregon. For the record, my name is Michael Lang. I'm Conservation Director for Friends of the Columbia Gorge. And the Columbia River Gorge, as you know well, is a National Scenic Treasure. The Columbia River Gorge is protected by the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area Act, whose purposes are to protect and enhance the scenic, natural, cultural, and recreation resources of the Columbia River Gorge. The Act is implemented through a bi-state compact between Oregon and Washington, which in essence says that the two states will join together and implement and enforce the National Scenic Area Act. In particular, it says in ORS 196.150, and I'm just saying that from memory, but I have the text here, that the governor, the Gorge Commission, and here's the important part, that all state agencies are hereby directed and provided authority to carry out their respective functions or responsibilities in accordance with the National Scenic Area Act. And that would include, for the purposes of this discussion, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and one of its respective functions, protecting and enhancing air quality. There are air quality concerns in the Columbia River Gorge that are significant. The Forest Service has been monitoring air quality in the gorge since 1993. In 1999, the Forest Service produced an air quality report which had the following findings. Air quality and visibility in the Columbia River Gorge is degraded to the point of impairing visibility and adversely affecting natural resources. The report is based on air quality monitoring data accumulated since 1993. The results are the following. Visibility in the National Scenic Area is significantly impaired. That sulfur is a dominant pollution causing visibility impairment, along with nitrogen and carbon. Ozone levels are high enough to adversely impact terrestrial ecosystems. That metals, sulfur, nitrogen concentrations are comparable to concentrations found in very polluted urban areas. That levels of lead detected in lichen samples in the Columbia River Gorge are extraordinarily high. Why lichen? It's considered the canary in the coal mine, I guess, for terrestrial ecosystems. That cultural resources such as rock art may be adversely affected, and that the primary sources of air pollution, at least in the Western Gorge, are Portland and Vancouver area sources and some sources within the scenic area. And although this wasn't included in the report, it's the majority of the pollution from the Portland-Vancouver area is considered to be mobile sources, cars, trains, trucks, and then within the gorge, barges and trains also play a significant factor. Then in 2000, the Forest Service released a visibility study finding that visibility is impaired 95% of the time in the Columbia River Gorge, with significant impairment occurring 21% of the time. So more problems. Recently, in February, in fact, the Forest Service released a report, the summary of which I've handed out to you, and I just had a couple copies of the actual study itself. What it sought to do, this study, was to determine fog water deposition in the Eastern Gorge. In other words, acidic content in fog water and in clouds and to a certain degree in rain in the Eastern Columbia River Gorge. And in the summary, the findings are as follow, and I'll just summarize too to move things along. The deposition rates determined from earlier lichen studies in the Eastern Gorge indicated nitrogen rates of 10 kilogram hectares per year. For ecosystems, deposition rates of sulfur and nitrogen above 3 to 5 kilogram hectares per year are harmful. Risk increases as the rates increase. These values are based on critical load studies in Europe and the United States. There are few who support critical load levels of 2 kilograms per hectare per year for aquatic ecosystems. Potential harm to Native American cultural resources, for example, rock art, petroglyphs, and pictographs in the Eastern Gorge. Also, ecosystem and archaeological resources is a significant concern. Ammonium and acidity are the primary deposition risk to rock art. Lichen and other biota fed by nitrogen deposition on rock surfaces are potentially detrimental. As far as the conclusions, the fog water picked up in the gorge, the pH was generally quite acidic. Three acidic episodes characterized an extreme were 3.6 to 3.8 pH range, which is equivalent to vinegar. Most pH samples were in the low 4-point range. The conclusions are the following. Acid deposition is occurring throughout the gorge. Detrimental effects of deposition on archaeological resources in other locations is well known. The effects on rock art and basalt rock in the gorge requires further study, but at these levels, one could assume that there is a high risk to Native American rock art. Ecosystem harm is certain. This was known from lichen studies where pollution-sensitive lichen are absent. Species which thrive on nitrogen pollution are abundant in the gorge. These species are not native. They're essentially weeds. And then high nitrogen and sulfur deposition, summer ozone effects, associated insect and disease infestations, and drought are compounding effects within the National Scenic Area. There's clearly an air quality and visibility problem in the Columbia River Gorge. There is a western problem that's not exactly the same as eastern problem. I think we recognize that mobile sources play a large role in air pollution in the western gorge. Senate Bill 344, I think, would partially address that problem and may bring about some improvements. In the eastern gorge, the sources are thought to be industrial power plants, the Boardman coal-fired power plant, natural gas power plants that are throughout the Columbia Basin, and also agricultural sources, for example, fertilizers that are used, herbicides that are used throughout the basin, are kicked up in wind within the winter.
Just another second, please.
Okay, just briefly, the Gorge Commission adopted an air quality strategy, or not a strategy, requirement to adopt a strategy, I should say, in 2000. And what it requires is air quality to be protected and enhanced. It also requires the state air quality agencies to work with the Forest Service, and I'll just read it. Based on the analysis, the state shall develop and implement a regional air quality strategy to carry out the purposes of the Scenic Area Act. Jumping ahead, it says that a work plan shall be developed. The first annual report to the commission shall include a work plan and a timeline for gathering, analyzing data, and developing and implementing the strategy. The state agencies did develop a very nice, well-produced, very pretty work plan. It has not been fulfilled. This year, we are supposed to adopt and implement an air quality strategy. We're years away from it. And part of the problem is that, unfortunately, both the Department of Ecology in Washington, which is completely backed out of the program, and our own Oregon Department of Environmental Quality have failed to implement an air quality strategy in the Columbia River Gorge. Even when we have reports like this coming out at least every couple of years showing that there's a significant problem and it's not getting worse, it's getting better. And that would conclude my testimony. Oh, and just one more thing about pi. We round pi off all the time. So, 3.14, come on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Okay, thank you.
DEQ has a lot of room for improvement all the way around, I think. Jenny Holmes? Is it Holmes or Helms?
Holmes.
Holmes.
Chair Ringo, a member of the committee. My name is Jenny Holmes, and I'm the Program Director for Ecumenical Ministries Interfaith Network for Earth Concerns and coordinator for the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign, which is hosted at Ecumenical Ministries. The Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign includes over 20 denominations and faith groups that participate on a regular basis. And we reflect the sentiments of leadership at the highest levels of religious institutions in our country. There is strong agreement that global warming is a profound moral issue of our time that demands urgent action. Since 2000, members of the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign have been advocating for policies at the state and national level that will help our nation take responsibility for its share of global warming pollution. It distresses us that our nation, who contributes 25% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, has failed to take decisive action. We are called to be good stewards and wise managers of the gifts of creation that God has given us. Now, stewardship of the world's atmosphere, upon which all life depends, must come to the fore. We have a clear moral obligation and urgency to protect human life, human health, and all of creation. And we agree that now is the time to act on the fact that there is leading world scientific consensus that global warming is real and is largely caused by human activity. One of our foundational principles is justice, justice for the poor and vulnerable who will be most affected by global warming and for generations that are yet unborn. Here in Oregon, we are concerned about how global warming will affect the livelihood of farmers who depend on snowpack-dependent irrigation and communities that will have to face more frequent forest fires, as well as those in poor health and the elderly who will have to endure worse air pollution and summer heat waves. We are very pleased that Oregon is considering adopting California's four-sided tailpipe emission standards for carbon dioxide. We applaud the House in Washington State for passing a bill to adopt the standards and for the Canadian government for its recent historic agreement with automobile manufacturers to achieve a 25% increase in fuel efficiency. Vehicle emissions, as we've heard earlier, are a major source of greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. California standards are safe and affordable. They are designed to be flexible and cost-effective to the consumer. They will not take away choices. The SUVs and minivans will still be available in spite of what the scare taxes of the automobile lobby may want us to believe. Adoption of these standards is the right thing for the health of Oregonians who will breathe cleaner air, and it's the right thing for slowing global warming. We strongly support this action, and it's time for Oregon to be a leader in responsible stewardship. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fern Groves. Alex Fides.
Hello. I had prepared some comments, but seeing as how most of the issues I wanted to address have already been...
Could you just state your name on the record?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm sorry. It's Alex Fides. I'm a citizen of Portland, Oregon, and I'm just here on behalf of... I'm actually here on behalf of myself. I just wanted to say that I support Senate Bill 344. I prepared some comments, rather than be repetitive, I'm just going to skip them and say that I really appreciate everything you all are doing on this issue, and I really think it's, in my opinion, it's not a question of when or whether to implement low-emission vehicle standards, but when to implement these stricter standards, and I would like to see Oregon be a leader on this issue.
Thanks. Alex, I really appreciate you coming to testify today. One thing that I would encourage you to do is contact your legislators. Do you know who they are?
I believe, well, I know who my congressional legislators are.
Yeah. Get on the web and see who your state representative is and who your state senator is, and contact them and get your friends to contact their senators and representatives and turn the heat up. Okay?
Will do.
So then we can turn it down over there.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's what it takes, though. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for holding
okay.
this hearing.
John Charles? Afraid you weren't coming back after lunch.
Just had a few small things to take care of. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Charles, Cascade Policy Institute. I've spent most of my adult life working on air pollution issues and helped pass a lot of environmental laws in Oregon related to this subject in the 1980s and early 1990s. But I just want to call your attention to some risks associated with Senate Bill 344, which is that it would impose perhaps substantial upfront costs on consumers with only speculative environmental benefits, in part because the anthropogenic emissions of CO2 worldwide compared to the natural emissions are only about 3%, and Oregon's share of total anthropogenic worldwide are a fraction of the 3. So I'm not sure exactly what difference we're going to make, especially when water vapor is the most predominant greenhouse gas anyway. So, you know, we have this sort of tiny little part of the tail wagging something here. And because all these gases exist for a long period of time, the people who will pay for this through upfront costs, it's unlikely they will ever see any benefits at all. So you have to weigh all of that versus, you know, cost versus benefits. The second point, as indicated in the attachments I've given you, is if you look at all the actual data trends in the economy, I mean, one of the miracles of the economy is that it's been decarbonizing on its own, more or less, for over 50 years. Energy consumption per dollar of GDP has declined by 52% since 1949. CO2 emissions per dollar of GDP have dropped by 38% since 1980. In fact, if you look at the chart I provide on page 2, I mean, it's a very, to me, exhilarating set of data trends that while GDP rises, we've clearly decoupled economic output from energy consumption, and energy unit per GDP is declining while we are growing the economy. I mean, to me, that is the mark of a sustainable economy, that every single year, over 50 years now, we've been doing more with less through billions and billions of decisions in the market economy every day. My final point, I noticed I have some data sets also attached regarding energy intensities of various transportation modes, and you can see the stunning success in automobiles and light trucks. The trend is exactly reverse in transit buses and rail transit, where energy consumption keeps rising every year, while in the motor vehicle category, energy consumption has been dropping for decades. Since we spend billions of dollars of public money trying to get people into transit, you might consider, you know, investigating the performance of transit. My final point is one of the large unintended consequences of this bill will be to make it more difficult for low-income, transit-dependent job seekers to buy automobiles. And while I am very familiar with life cycle analysis and as a consumer have frequently done the calculation of how much I am willing to pay up front over what period of time to recover it, the data clearly indicates that if you are a job seeker and you're transit dependent, your chances of getting a job are far less than if you had a car. In fact, one of the more interesting studies has been done here at Portland State just 2 years ago, showing that for people without a high school diploma, car ownership improved the likelihood of being employed by 80%, and the effect on average weekly wages was approximately $275 more by owning a car. So life cycle analysis is great if you have the means, the financial means to make those calculations, but when you are on the edge and 80 or 90% of the jobs you're trying to go apply to, you can't even get because you don't own a car. When you raise the price of a car, there are impacts on people, and the people who are going to be hurt the most are the people who are already at the lowest rung of society. So just keep in mind that that's one of the likely unintended consequences of passing this bill, and the benefits are pretty much speculative.
Just a couple questions, Mr. Charles. Thanks for coming this afternoon. There was a discussion by an earlier witness about the externalities of driving vehicles and the pollution involved, and we've also heard some testimony about how the pollution, the particulates, have real human health impacts, whether it's cancers, whether it's asthma, and I guess the first question is, I mean, do you accept that science, that there are real human health impacts because of air particulates related to pollution?
Well, certainly related to particulates or ground-level ozone or NOx, but those are already regulated under the Clean Air Act, and they have been declining spectacularly for decades, and this bill is not about them. This bill is about something that is not even a pollutant, CO2.
Okay, but the idea that the idea that air pollution is a matter of public health concern is something you don't dispute.
I don't dispute when it actually is air pollution.
Okay. Yeah.
CO2, scientifically and legally, is not a pollutant. And notwithstanding what Angus Duncan said, words in your business matter. It's not semantics. CO2 is not a pollutant.
No, that's fine. But there's other issues. I mean, we heard testimony that there are other. Adopting the California vehicle emission standards would include other matters, not just CO2, but other particulates that do have human health impacts. That also is one of the things that would be included if we adopt CO2.
I've worked California for decades emissions. Promoting fine particulate standards and carbon monoxide and every source of pollution in Oregon that is regulated, I've worked on, and when there are real externalities and real health effects, that is appropriate. That's right.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm sorry. Did Catherine Thomason leave? Okay. Let's see. Catherine Lynn? Thanks for being patient.
Chairman Ringo, Senator Shields, thank you for having this public hearing. My name is Catherine Lynn, for the record, and I, too, like Jared Kahn, am a law student at Lewis and Clark, and I'm also a member of NEDC. And I would just like to make a few comments. I do support Senate Bill 344, and I appreciate all your efforts thus far in supporting the bill and the public health and welfare of citizens of Oregon. And I would just like to make a few points in terms of susceptible populations and the effects of emissions from vehicle exhaust, primarily diesel exhaust. Generally, the populations that are most affected are rarely included in averaging standards that tend to be the national standards. It's under the assumption that people are exposed on an hourly basis at the same time to the same amount of pollution, and it doesn't take into consideration susceptible populations such as children who are often on school buses 1 to 2 hours a day, and they are exposed to higher amounts of diesel exhaust, and this is very detrimental to their health. And so I wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 344 in taking stricter measures into account for children's health. And it's been recognized that children with chronic illnesses such as asthma is the number one cause of school absenteeism for children. So that's really what I just wanted to say, and I wholeheartedly support this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good luck in law school. Jeremy Wright.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeremy Wright. I am the environmental advocate from Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. And I have prepared testimony, but like others, a lot has already been said on this. I will point out a couple things, though. I urge the committee and all members of the legislature to be highly skeptical of the claims being put forward by all the manufacturers and dealers. The reason you say this is because for 40 years, they have made sky is falling claims over and imposed every single environmental and consumer effort and has not come true. And I wanted to, for instance, when Congress was attempting to pass the Clean Air Act in 1970, Lee Iacocca, the executive vice president of Ford Motor Company at that time, said about the Clean Air Act, "This bill
could prevent continued production of automobiles and is a threat to the entire American economy and to every person in America. That was in 1970. Obviously, the American economy has continued, and we are still selling cars at a greater rate than ever before. Another example is in 1980s when the EPA proposed stronger emission standards, which were called Tier 2. The Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association said that achieving the Tier 2 standards is, quote, not technologically feasible. This was untrue as well. Automakers met the Tier 2 standards within a reasonable period of time and have been producing cars for the last several years that comply with Tier 2. So, as you can say, the rhetoric does not match the reality over the last 40 years, and I encourage you to reject that. And finally, for the gentleman from the Cascade Policy Institute, I will point out that while we've had reductions in emissions, we also have had the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, CAFE standards. There's a direct correlation here in the last 40 years between reductions in law. And therefore, Senate Bill 344 is another step along that path, and I urge passage. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Those are interesting stories about Lee Iacocca and the Tier 2. Yuri Pudiev? I guess it doesn't matter. Let's see here. Is Dave Stewart Smith here, Department of Energy? Obviously, we're getting near the end here. Daryl Fuller, is he here? He was here earlier. Dave Gayton, are you going to want to testify? You're not on the list. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Shields. My name is Dave Stewart Smith. I'm the Assistant Director for Energy Resources for the Oregon Department of Energy. One way or another, American automobile fuel efficiency is going to improve. Our global petroleum production capacity is nearing its peak. Soon, it will begin to decline. By adopting California's vehicle emission standards, we can accomplish a transition to more efficient vehicles in a smoother fashion than relying on price increases at the pump to push us kicking and screaming all the way toward making those changes. California's emission standards primarily deal with pollutant reduction. But as we often see in the energy world, these types of adoptions would also have a secondary benefit of improving energy efficiency. Approximately 20% of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions are from passenger vehicle exhaust. Oregon's CO2 reduction strategy that you've heard so much about today, with regards to transportation, makes recommendations to improve land use, develop a biofuels industry, and adopt the California vehicle emission standards, among others. The CO2 emission reductions from California vehicle emission standards represent over 75% of the total from all of the transport recommendations in the report of the governor's task force. Adopting the California vehicle emission standards is the single most effective tool to reduce our dependency on oil and those emissions. Adopting these standards is good for consumers. By law, these standards must be cost-effective. Therefore, the added cost to consumers will be recouped during the life of the vehicle. And as gasoline prices continue to increase, the payback on these standards will be reduced. According to the California Air Resources Board, by 2020, the estimated savings from maximum feasible technology will result in about an 18% reduction in total greenhouse gas emissions from passenger cars and light-duty trucks, a 27% reduction by 2030. New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, and Maine have adopted the California Motor Vehicle Emission Control Program under the Clean Air Act, and the state of Washington has passed its bill through one chamber. So we are in good company, and I urge that this bill and other efforts along those same lines go forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I appreciate your testimony. Do you have anything written to provide?
I do not. I can certainly put something together if you'd like me to.
No, I just found, I mean, your perspective on reducing energy dependence was kind of another facet of this that we haven't talked too much about.
We use 40% of our energy use in the state of Oregon is transportation related, and it's also by far the most inefficient use of energy.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anybody in the audience who hasn't testified but would like to? Well, then I'd ask Dr. Lubchenco then to return for
a couple minutes of response to some of the testimony she may have heard.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I think you've heard a lot of very interested and concerned testimony. It's clear that there's a lot of interest in this topic, and I congratulate you for having these hearings and introducing the bill. Some of the points that I think have been inaccurate have already been answered in some of the back and forth in earlier testimony. The more recent comments by Mr. Charles of the Cascade Policy Institute might be ones that I could address very briefly.
Sure.
There were two issues that he raised that I think bear a closer look. One, he made a point that about water vapor being a lot more common than carbon dioxide. I think it's useful for the committee to know that, as I indicated in my testimony, there are a number of different greenhouse gases. CO2 is the one that we talk about most often because that was the first one for which we had significant measurements. In addition to carbon dioxide, we know that there are other very important greenhouse gases. Methane, nitrous oxide, water vapor are among those. And those are all taken into account in all of the international results that I was quoting. I think relevant to your interests, what is most important is to note that carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide are the ones that human activities has significantly increased, and those are the ones that we have the power to begin to decrease if we want to keep the climate system from going into very, very dangerous territory. And so it makes a lot of sense to me, at least, that the ones that we have increased, we know that we've increased carbon dioxide by 30% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and the bill that you're considering would be a very important step in beginning to reduce Oregon's CO2 emissions. There are other efforts that need to parallel that to reduce methane, nitrous oxide, other greenhouse gases. So I think it's just important to put the water vapor into perspective. The other thing that I noted in his testimony, his comments about economic trends indicating that the U.S. economy has been decarbonizing through market forces is a sleight of hand set of calculations because it's crafted as carbon dioxide per unit of GDP. And it's because over the last 50 years, GDP has been growing significantly. It's pretty meaningless. What's really important to the climate system and to ecological systems and to human health is the absolute amount of carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere. And that's appropriately where we should focus our attention.
Okay.
I hope that's helpful.
Thank you very much. Actually, those were very interesting clarifications.
Can we go for 3 hours?
I've been here the whole time, and they're not tired of me yet.
Senator Shields.
Thank you.
Everybody else in the room testified while you were gone. And now she's back to respond.
Well, it's a real pleasure.
Welcome back, Senator.
Thank you.
I since you've been talking about John Charles' testimony, can you put in context the statement CO2 is not a pollutant, just in broader context and
this really is
a five-word statement.
Yeah, well, this was this is politics at its worst, probably. CO2 is an important greenhouse gas. It has very demonstrable influence on climate. Whether it is has been ruled by the Environmental Protection Agency has said that it is not a pollutant because the Bush administration said it was not a pollutant. And so that's a legal issue that really is, I think, a red herring. Whether it's classified as a legal pollutant or not, it has very strong ecological and environmental consequences, as well as health consequences. Whether it's classified as a pollutant or not is less important than the actual consequences that it has. Does that help?
Yes, it does.
The Clinton administration considered it a pollutant. The Bush administration considers it not a pollutant. And so this is political declarations defining how we label things, essentially.
Right. Yeah, and to say, okay, Bush administration says it's not a pollutant, but it has serious ecological consequences for everybody on the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the important message.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Lubchenco, thank you very much for coming and being with us today, and thanks to everybody in the audience for your time in this hearing. And I think this is a very important bill to move forward, and we'll see what we do. So thanks very much, and have a good weekend, everybody. This committee is adjourned.